It gives me great pleasure to turn the microphone and the floor over to the Sheriff of Erie County, Timothy B. Howard.
Thank you, Matt. I think we begin first with the calling of Erie County Sheriff's Honor Guard to post the colors. Please post the colors. If you would all please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. If you'd all please be seated. Could just use this one. There we go. Just getting everything technical set up here. I just want to add my welcome to PX 2010. I would just say this to all the people in the audience that after today, if you never did anything else, if you never lifted another finger in demonstration or to the advancement of our cause here today, the mere fact that you've come here today and shown that your personal awareness, without your personal, your individual, or your collaborative efforts, you have still helped us simply by giving some recognition to the fact that we all know or we're beginning to realize and spread the word that underage drinking is everyone's problem. So I thank everybody for taking the time here to be here today. Commissioner, if you want to stay at that table, you're welcome. But I think if you want to join me in center stage, we'll mostly be sitting here, but it's your choice what you want to do. But I'm very pleased to introduce the first speaker, Phil Endres, who's the commissioner of the Erie County Department of Health, of Mental Health. He's a tremendous advocate to keeping our community safe, and we're very pleased that he can join us here to help get things started. Commissioner?
Good morning and welcome. As Sheriff Howard indicated, I'm Phil Endres, and I'm Commissioner of Mental Health from Erie County. And on behalf of the newly created PX20 and all of its organizational members in the department, I want to thank you for joining us for this very important kickoff event today. Never before in our region's history has there been such a crucial blending of alcohol treatment, drug abuse prevention, treatment providers, mental health advocacy groups, and as well as school providers, the sheriff's law enforcement, other law enforcement agencies coming together in a unified common mission to address the important issue of underage drinking in our community. To launch this effort and the creation of the PX20, a group of behavioral health leaders have been meeting for more than 2 years, leading to the creation of the Comprehensive Prevention Plan. I believe that that is in your folders. Today, this plan is unveiled to the community, and its first platform is a campaign to address a significant problem of underage drinking in our community. The PX20 organization and its website will offer a vast array of important information on the comprehensive plans, the projects of the PX20, media contacts, contacts, and information for all of our community to get actively involved. Today is a call for action. Your attendance today is truly impressive. It is encouraging and vital to the success of this plan, moving from an idea to a reality and helping to kick off our initial campaign. Please join us in our efforts, and we embrace our ambitious but achievable objectives. Please understand that together we can impact our community in truly positive and life-enhancing ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner, for helping us get this started. Our next speaker, I had the pleasure of meeting for the first time probably about 15 minutes ago, and I've already heard her make two speeches, one to the media and one to the fellow organizers of this event. I wish that I had met her before, although I am aware of her work. She brings tremendous energy to her profession as well as to our cause here. So please help me welcome Commissioner of the New York State Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, Karen M. Carpenter Palumbo. The commissioner took office in January of 2007 and currently oversees one of the nation's largest addiction systems, including more than 1,550 providers that treat 110,000 New Yorkers on any given day. This field encompasses a workforce of 35,000 paid and volunteer talent, including nearly 7,400 OASIS-credentialed prevention and treatment professionals. Commissioner is a strong advocate for all efforts designed to combat underage drinking. Commissioner.
Thank you, Sheriff Howard. Very, very nice. And it was great meeting you. And then he tells me that his son's a trooper, you know, in Albany. And I said, well, I obviously know him, you know, because I have a long record. You know, I accept all tickets. I beg them. My kids love this. Because if I've gotten stopped on occasion, I have that lead foot that everybody speaks about. And I get stopped and they'll see, you know, the car and they'll say, come here, no ticket. And I said, no. I'm on my own time. You give me a ticket. And so the kids, obviously, when they're talking to other people, mommy begs for tickets. And I was like, that's good. That's good. That's good impression for them to make. She begs for tickets. That's good. You know, and so does my bank account. But anyway, I'm thrilled to be here. And it's an honor to see you all come together, because this is exactly the environmental strategy for prevention of underage drinking, substance abuse, and any other addictions. We have 2.5 million New Yorkers today. 2.5 million New Yorkers with an addiction. Alcohol, substance abuse, or gambling. All right? 2.5 million New Yorkers, one in seven. One in seven in this room, one in seven when we walk down the street, one in seven when I was on the waterfront or Cole's restaurant yesterday. Well, you look around, one in seven. We need to know that the churches, the schools, you know, everywhere we are. You know, and it's adults and kids. So we have to pay attention to that number. And you're doing the work by coming together, you know, and PX 2010 is a way to achieve that. You know, I was so impressed when I saw just the list of, you know, this is what counts. As you said, I think this morning, Sheriff, you know, the list is not only the agencies that have all committed, you know, but the people that are here that know you have a problem. Right? What do we know in the field? You got to first recognize that there's a problem. And a lot of times people don't want to do that. There are not counties across the state that have this coalition. We're trying, you know, and we will be able to use places like Erie County as an example to the rest of the state, because that is my job. I told the breakfast folks this morning, you give me, you know, what you want to see achieved, you know, and what are your number one priorities, and it's my job to take what you're doing and move it, you know, when it's successful, move it across the state, you know, because what happens in Erie County, people in Long Island should know about it, right? And you have an ability to share best practices. You know, and it's amazing, even just some of the things, you know, learning about the, superintendent, what do you call that program? What do you call the program? Mandatory parent meetings. That's good. Mandatory parent meetings. Now, this is phenomenal. You know, you want your kid to go to the dance? You come for the 90-minute, you know, discussion of underage drinking. You know, you will be educated. I don't care if you like it or not. You will be educated. But what did you say parents left with? An awareness? Some of them crying? You know, you don't think they're going to not remember that video? And maybe that's the reason that they're going to have, you know, the ability to say, and I talk to parents, you know, I'm on the PTA. I talk to my kids in middle school, going into high school. This is all, you know, part of the conversation. But maybe that'll give that parent the opportunity and the strength to say, you know what, you're not going to have that party here Friday night at our house. You know, we're not going to do it. You know, you're not going to drink. And I am going to call the other parent's house to see who's going to supervise, you know, you over there, because we know, you know, what happens, you know, to the kid, you know, and what can happen, you know, when the party gets bigger, you know, and all of a sudden you have no control. But we're also, and frankly, this is something that Long Island has spearheaded, you know, that we will hold parents liable, you know, liable financially, you know, and you can lose your house. So you make that decision if you want to be the cool parent that offers the party, you know, or, you know, the one that's responsible. So I think you've come together and you've begun to do that, and it's thrilling to see all in the room. Just law enforcement, I just want to get a kind of show of hands which section you come from. Law enforcement, and then we've got kind of the prevention, human services side of the house. Okay, you know, oh, you're mixing up. That's good, you know. And education, and all right, good. And the business community, all about fantastic. So you've got the elements. Now I'm going to encourage you, you know, to look and obviously keep looking of what more you can do. So you know the problem better than I do. Alcohol still number one choice, still number one addiction, you know, in our state, in the country. And oftentimes we forget that because we hear about, you know, the prescription drug use absolutely growing, you know, among our youth, absolutely growing, doing these, have you heard, this is new to me, trail mix parties, farming parties. You take everything that's in the grandparents' cabinet or your cabinet and my aunt's cabinet, and we throw it in, you know, a big bin, and we just pop pills. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing that growing. But it never, right now, has met the number of concerns we have about abuse, about alcohol. So what is the fact that we have? One-third of New Yorkers aged 12 to 20 consumed alcohol in the past month. One third. That's 792,000 kids in your neighborhood and across the state. And what do we know? It's illegal. It's about access. It's about enforcement. But what I've learned through this whole time, you know what I mean, and certainly as commissioner and before, and I've learned from all of you, you know, in prevention, is that we've got to stop the preaching. Right, the preaching, you know, sometimes the assemblies and the preaching at people, and you cannot. Our best information comes from the kids themselves, that they say, you know what, let me make the decisions. Teach me how to make the decisions. And we have a great college campaign, you know, called I Decide campaign. And they really, again, taught us about, you know, teach me how to make the right decisions. I decide what kind of music I'm going to listen to. I decide who my friends are. And I decide whether or not I'm going to put myself at risk for drug and alcohol. Because they said, enough with you people, you know what I mean, coming and telling us what's wrong. Give us the tools to decide. And, you know, I'm way off point now, but my training is an ER social worker. Right, and when I leave this, well, I do ER social work right now. That's what you do. You're in crisis all the time. But my training was that, and you know, very difficult sometimes with the parents. Oftentimes we'd have kids coming in, you know, it was a long time ago, but kids coming in, you know, to do the potential suicide, the fake suicide, we'd call it, to get attention, you know. So what we would do, and the parents, some of them would pass out, I'd go in and say to the kids, okay, listen, you tried to slit your wrist this way, you know what I mean? If you really want to do it, you got to slit up. You got to go all the way. If you want to die, you have to slit it this way, all right, because nobody's going to watch you 24/7. You have to decide whether or not right now, when you leave this room, you know whether or not you want to live. It's not going to be your parents that are going to convince you. It's not going to be your friends. It's you decide. And I think we've learned all the time, all along, especially with addiction, that with kids, we've got to educate. Yes, we have to supervise. Yes, we're going to enforce. But we have to educate so they have the information. We've seen it in smoking. The smoking rates in our state have plummeted. You know, we were at 18%. Now we're at 16%. You know, I think I take credit that we helped it along by having all our programs go tobacco-free, first in the country. You know, just like your program here, you know what I mean, the mandatory parent education. I think a nicer title, something a little more punchy, because I can't get out. The commissioner can't say mandatory parent education in one sentence. I get it. It's good. But, I mean, the title, you know, spreads the message. But how incredible that is. How incredible that is. And that's where it all starts, you know. And so we have, you know, and what the one in our recent report, our youth study developmental survey that we just did, what really concerned me the most was in that same study, one in five kids had binge drink last month. One in five. You know, so we know it's illegal. You know, they're still getting access. And they're binge drinking, which we know all, you know, any of the mind faculties go awry. You know, we don't know what we're doing after that on the binge drinking. So that's our work. four out of five high school students had a drink by the time they were seniors. Statewide, it's 80%. I think your number here, Phil, is 30%. Pretty good, you know, pretty good, but it's still 30%. Right? So, you know, we're not going to do this. You know, everything is bad in Erie County. Everything, you know, is below the statewide average. That's not the case. You've come together. You've made a difference. Now you have to do even more because, you know, it's prom season. We just talked about it. It's the dances. It's all that. And this is the time where inevitably it's going to be in the paper and everybody's going to do, oh, my God, so sad, horrible, such a tragedy. So we're saying for all of you, and I think that's why it is a call to action today, you know, and you're doing, what are we going to do before that? You know, we have, it was, you know, popular, unpopular. The governor signed Leander's Law into place. So if you're driving with a kid under the influence, under, you know, a young child under the influence, you know, you're going to be, you know, go right to prison. We had the first case in Albany, a doctor coming home from Proctor's, right? One too many drinks, but had the, after, I forgot the play, what did we have with the witches? Something, Wicked, which is Wicked, yes. So a play coming back, but she had one too many drinks, a prominent physician in our community, one too many drinks, but the 8-year-old and the 14-year-old were in the car. You know, there is no, you know, pass and go. She's immediately in the police station. Now, we went out, you know, because this was all because of the you know, the couple of cases in the city, Leander's Law, you know what I mean, of a woman that took, you know, a kid overnight and to a party and obviously was high and had been drinking and the one daughter died, and that was Leandra. But when we were first going out, interesting enough, the our team, you know, the governor's team wanted to go out, enforcement, we'll get you. We will get you. We crime, it's, you know, we're going to lock you up. And I said, no way. Well, that's not how we're going to present it. You know, we've just committed to Rockefeller drug reform where we're saying treatment first, right? Let's treat the problem. So we're going to go out in a package and we're going to say, absolutely, we will hold you accountable. But we are also going to offer you an opportunity for treatment. We're going to hold you accountable there too. And if you don't make it, you're going to jail. You know, but we're going to give you that option because we know today, and I was at Orleans Correctional Facility yesterday, I'm going to Albion today, 90% of the people that are in our prison system right now, and as taxpayers, you're paying $45,000 a year to keep someone in prison. 90% of them are there because of a drug or alcohol and or gambling addiction. 90%. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot to see, okay, if we treat them, you know, it for $10,000 to $30,000, you know, a year, you know, look at the savings we have, and maybe we have an opportunity to save lives at the same time. Wouldn't that be nice? And so we look at that both to say, what are we going to do to stop it? And when I inevitably, any treatment program of the 110,000 people we serve every day, and I did it yesterday, you know, I talk to the guys and say, hey, when did you first start drinking and drugging? 13, 14, 15. Always, always. The hands go up. And then I ask them for the ideas. And you know some of the best ideas, and this is where prevention, treatment, and recovery have to come together. These individuals and the kid who is 22 that maybe has been in treatment, you know, and now in recovery for 2 years, he's the kid that goes back to the school. Because he can say, not so long ago, I was sitting at this assembly, and I wasn't paying attention either. But let me tell you about my life. Let me tell you what the first drink did. Not all kids that drink, not all these kids in these survey obviously are going to be an alcoholic or a drug abuser. Absolutely not. But it's a start. It's a gateway. The facts say that. We know it. So why not have some of the people, you know, the younger folks go back, and we do that in many places. But, you know, one of the original papers that I did with Governor Spitzer and then David Patterson was prevention is the first prescription for a healthy New York. You know, we have to provide quality treatment, and then we have to recovery is also prevention. So how can we combine those? So as you continue on the prevention, you're also going to include your treatment providers. You're going to include the recovery individuals in your community because we have to do it together, and you've learned that. And obviously, I congratulate you for it. One of the things I want you to know, and everybody but Phil Endres can answer this, we have 2.5 million New Yorkers with an addiction. Any idea on what you would say, how many people in Erie County that we estimate have an addiction? Any idea? I have the numbers, so I know. Throw out a number. Anybody? So quiet. 300,000. Now I got to look at my number now that I just said that. No. It's generally. It's lower. 100,000. 100,000 people today that we estimate by the numbers in Erie County have an addiction. 100,000 people. How much do you think we're spending right now on substance abuse, prevention, treatment, and recovery in Erie County? All funds. Just a number. Yeah. 100 million? Other thoughts? 4 million. 8 million. Anybody else? $60 million. Today. $60 million. It's Medicaid money. It's OASIS money. All coming together. $60 million. How many people are you serving of the 100,000? Phil, you can't answer. These are your numbers. How many are you serving today, would you say? Any idea? Come on, folks. I'm up to this morning. You got to be up. You know what I mean? How many? 45,000. 30,000. Oh, I could do this. Couldn't you do an auctioneer? I could do that a little bit. You know, you, go. Yes, right. 10,000. Anybody else? 50,000. 25,000. The answer is 15,000. 15,000 people. So $60 million, you know, and I'm not making any judgments. $60 million is being spent on 15,000 people. Now, I will qualify that. That does not count all the prevention people that you see every year, and it's about 60,000 kids over a year, you know, that you serve in prevention, but that's a one-time, you know, it's kind of one and two and three-timer. When we look at all the numbers combined, that's what you're serving, unique individuals, all right? And, you know, the good and bad of it is, and I got to look at my stat right now, you are serving 13.8% of the need. That's good news. That's good news. In the state right now, we serve 15% of the need, highest in the country, highest in the country. And if any of you looked at it, and certainly when you look in schools, 15%, that's not a very good grade. But 15%, we are the highest in the country. We serve more individuals in New York State than any other state in the country. So that's good news. But here's the challenge. When we look at these communities of solution, we want you to look community by community, in this case, Erie County, and sometimes it's going to be, you know, suburbs and in different school districts, and we can run these numbers for all of them. You know, but we want you to look at what you have currently in the community, because our budget right now for OASIS is a $2 billion budget. And my contention is, you know, will we ever have enough money? No. But we got a lot of money. We have a lot of money that we can spend and move around now. And those are decisions that you can make. And sometimes state government has to get out of the way. And that's what my job is. To look in, and Phil is right on top of this, you know, coming to us with proposals to make sure that we can maybe take from this pot of money, move it over to this pot of money, you know, and to serve more people. So my challenge to you is that what we want to see happen over the next, you know what I mean, 3 years, is that we go all counties in the state come to 15%. Come to 15%, which for you means an additional, I'm sure they'll give me the math somewhere. Okay, well, I don't have the math, and I can't add it up in my mind, but somebody can do that. So it's serving an additional, okay, good. All right, that's good. I'll give you that. All right, 1,500, because I can't read it right now. So serving an additional 1,500 people. Now, that's not just running them through. You know, that's not running them through. It's looking at access. What's the front door look like, you know, where you come in? We look at it at schools. We look at it at hospitals. We also are looking at treatment programs, you know, and prevention programs. What's it look like? Now, if you're going into a program, you know, and the first thing you see on the door is, don't use this door, use this one, right? Our folks are out of there. They're out of there. They don't want to be there anyway. You know what I mean? And just give me one excuse, and we're out of there. So, you know, what more are we going to do to be more welcoming? And one of the things I talked about this morning is we're trying to institute looking at all our clinics, and I think you have like 58 different programs, right, Phil? Something, is I have 69 different programs. Did you know that? No, okay. You have 69 different OASIS-certified programs right here in your county. So we're looking at all of them, and where's Patrick Morrison? Patrick, everybody know Patrick? He's our Buffalo area rep for OASIS. Go talk to him, bug him, ideas. You know, he gets them to us. The idea is to look at what does the entry look like? Is it a welcoming access? Because we're not getting people in the door. Right? Always, we're not getting people into the door. That's why programs like the mandatory parent education is phenomenal, because, you know, you're saying you got to come to the door. And yes, we are holding your kid hostage, because you know what? By doing that, we're probably going to save his life, you know, and save you from heartache. So very, very important to look at that. So I guess the in your call to action, what I'd like to say to you today is you do have a lot of money that you're spending in Erie County. And what I'm offering you the opportunity is, certainly with the things I have control over, or even the other state agencies, where do you think we could shift the money? One of the areas that I talked about is we're doing, you know, off-site services. We're taking a clinic and we're saying to the clinic, you know what? You can go provide services in the senior services center. You know, you can go in the doctor's office. You could go into the school. And you know what? You can get paid for it. You can get paid for it. And because it's a regulation that I have to just get out of the way, you know, and allow you to do that. You can't just go and run kids through. You have to have a certain space, and it has to be confidential and all these things. But look at the partnership that we can provide. Because then it's very different, as you all know, it's very different for the mom and the kid to go to the doctor's office to talk to somebody about their substance abuse than going into the substance abuse clinic. As a beginning, as an early screening and as early intervention, when you first see, you know, that it's an issue. And that's part of the community coming together. First see it's an issue. And by the way, it's not just you in your job, right? It's you as a parent. It's you as somebody in church. You know, do you think it's very comfortable for me in my school district when I have to go, you know, to another parent that I've obviously seen them, you know what I mean, you know, at a restaurant, you know, pummeling them down, and, you know, we're there for a kid's birthday party, and I know they're taking kids home. You think it's comfortable for me as a parent in that community to say, you know what, Sue, you can't do it. What are you doing? You can't go. Oh, Jesus, just because you're the commissioner, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Big fight. But you know what? That's on me. If I don't do something about that as a parent, that's on me, and it's on you. And so part of what we have to educate is everybody in the community, you know, whether you're a business official, whether, you know, you're a mom, whether you're, you know what I mean, an aunt, it's on us to stop that, you know, and educate people on how they can do it and help parents. And hopefully maybe that's something we add to the mandatory parent education. Like, what do I do in that situation? That everybody wants to know that. You know, I'm a social worker. I, you know what I mean? I know how to, you know, do an intervention. I didn't really want to because, you know what I mean, this kid and, you know, this mom is on a softball team with my kid. She's the team parent. You know what I mean? This is going to be hell. My summer is going to be hell, I can tell you. But, you know, but it's the right thing to do. And that's what we have to keep telling people. So I don't know what my time is, so cut me off when I need to. But the other thing that I wanted to talk about is just the idea of, you know, looking at what you can see in your community each and every day and taking that today and maybe coming up with the 5 or 10 things that you say you've always wanted to do. If only we could do this, why can't we move money from here to there? You know, I think you talked this morning, you know, you need more people, you know what I mean? We need more funding. Well, I'm saying to you, there isn't any, surprise. But you still have $60 million to play with. Yes, some of it's Medicaid money, and we'd have to talk to people. But some of it, about $15 million of it, comes directly from OASIS. And that's my turf, right? And so I can help you make decisions on what to do. I'm never, if somebody, one county came to me and said, we're only going to do treatment in our county. We don't want to do prevention and recovery. No. Okay, that's one of the things I'm going to say. You know, there's only parameters that I have. You must have prevention, you must have treatment, and you must be working towards recovery programs. That's all, you know, important. The proportion of that, you show me the numbers, and then we'll make the decision. But I think you have to think differently, you know, and now's the time to do it when we don't have any more money coming our way, you know. And I got a call yesterday, I got to make another $4 million cut, you know, on local assistance. The governor presented, you know, his budget, you know, to close the gap of $630 million on top of the $6 billion we already proposed. You know, I've got to take another $4 million, and let me tell you how we're going to do it. You know, we're not going to do any across-the-board cuts. Since I've taken office, we haven't done one across-the-board cut. We look at the performance of programs, what the need is, and make the cut that way. You know, is it ideal? No. And we talked a little bit this morning about we have report cards now, and we're doing report cards on prevention. You know, we're doing report cards on how programs are working, you know, and what they can do to improve. Not as a sanction, hopefully as an encouragement of best practices. Because if you're doing something great with these programs in Erie, I also think it's your obligation to tell the people in Chemung County and Nassau County. And vice versa. You may have some statistics that aren't so great here, you know, on retention or follow-through. And you want to get the information from people in St. Lawrence County and people in Dutchess County on what they're doing. And that, again, is my job to bring that all together. So I guess, you know, all in all, you need to understand that you're leading the way. You are leading the way with what you've come together with and by sitting here today. And you have to be congratulated on that. But I also am going to tell you also have another responsibility. And that responsibility is to look at what you can do to increase that number of people that get into treatment. What can you do to increase that number of the people that do participate in prevention programs? You know what I mean? I've already committed on this program that's phenomenal in Erie County. What my job now, I find a good program. My job is to make sure it goes statewide. right? And there's programs like this all across the state. I think, Sheriff, you mentioned about the tip line when you first found out about it and you wanted to get information. We're looking and talking about what is really the depository, a repository of all these programs so you can share those best practices, you know? And the ideas come from you. Because what happens in Albany County and what happens in Dutchess County and what happens in Chemung County is different than Erie County. And that's good. That's good. And that's why it comes together. That's why we call it community solutions, coming together by your community and what you can do differently. But more importantly, how we can help you get there. So I'm thrilled to be part of this process to help you kick it off. But I'm even more looking forward to what comes of it, you know, and what you ask of us is a partnership. Because you have the partnership on the local level. What's the partnership and what do I need to do personally and professionally and on behalf of the governor and as part of OASIS to make sure you can treat that additional 1,500 people? And more importantly, you know, we can prevent, you know, the illness to begin with. And you can make sure that you're doing everything possible to get that 13, 14, and 15-year-old. You know, and to make sure, you know, we do everything possible to prevent. And if we can't, we offer the highest quality treatment. No different than when you go, you know, when you're looking around maybe for your mother or your sister, like who's got the best bypass surgery rates, right? You're not going to go to somebody who has a 10%, you know, somebody who has done the gallbladder, who is, you know what I mean, or this Whipple procedure, which is a new one. It's old, but we're talking about it. But it's clearly the number of procedures that you do indicates the outcome. Well, if you've lost, you know, 100 of your cases, that's not where you're going to send your mother, you know what I mean, to have the surgery done. The same is true for us. You know, behavioral health is no different. We have outcome data. You know, how is it working? What are the environmental numbers in your community? Because if they're not going down, we've got to do something to make sure we reassess. And I think that's what you're doing with PX 2010. So I encourage it. I love it. But now the responsibility today is also on you on what more. You know, what is your list of things that you've always wanted to do as clinicians, you know, as community members and law enforcement to do exactly what it is to reduce underage drinking in Erie County? Thank you for having me here today. Really appreciate it. You know what I mean? It's a good opportunity to get out and talk to people. I don't know what our time is. I'm happy to do questions if that is helpful or not, or I'll sit down.
Well, I'm not cutting, not cutting her off at all for questions, but is there anybody here that doesn't agree with me that she brings a tremendous level of excitement and very clear knowledge to this problem? So we're very grateful that you could be here today. She also strikes me as a person that drinks a lot of coffee.
Yeah, no tea, but it's good.
It doesn't matter.
It's caffeine. Oh, thank you.
Mike, these are both for her?
So I get two? I got a matching set? Excellent.
For caffeine. And before we go back to the questions, we also have a certificate of appreciation. We know you have a very busy schedule. I know you have said you have a number of correctional facilities to visit, but we have a certificate of appreciation from the people here in Erie County. Her opening comments today after hearing from the organizing committee about some of what we did, that's wonderful, but now tell me, what can I do for you? So we do have a tremendous advocate here representing us in Albany, and we're very grateful that you could join us today. And please, if there's questions,
sure.
I don't mean to cut you off.
No, cut me off, because I'll keep going. Questions, thoughts, comments? Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you. This is great. Now, this group always has questions, because I go to all the meetings with you, so it's your time to talk to the commissioner.
Number one priority, if you could change anything, if you were commissioner today, what would it be? What would you do? I'm not giving up the job, you know, and I like it, you know, but what would you do?
Yes, my name is Christina Ambrose, and I'm actually here. I was going to wait until Sheriff Howard spoke, but I'm a concerned resident. I live in a rural community. I won't say where it is right now out of respect. I lived in Buffalo. I'm a recovering person. And if it wasn't for counseling and rehab back in the 70s, I wouldn't be here today. I started drinking when I was 11. I was in an alcoholic home, a lot of sexual abuse. When I was 11, that drink made everything go away.
Absolutely.
I knew I was a sick person, but I didn't know what to do. When I started working, I knew I was sick, so I started getting help. And back then, it was tough being a woman in the 70s.
Sure.
But places like Stutzman and outpatient counseling. I actually at the time was in the sheriff's building on Eagle Street, 134 West Eagle. Helped me get where I am today. So I thank you for that, invested in all kinds of counselors. Mm-hmm. I moved out to a rural area about 12 years ago. I grew up in Buffalo. I'm very aware of what drinking is all about and drugs. The problem is this. I feel you can talk about prevention, but it also starts in the community with residents. Mm-hmm. I bought a home, moved in an area where neighbor had a house of underage drinking. This was about 10 years ago, and it escalated to where it was very obvious that the drinking, the partying, the screaming, the yelling. This area only had two sheriffs. I would call the sheriffs, and they'd come, and basically what would happen is, and unfortunately this has to be a reality for everybody to know, because it doesn't just start going to a counselor. It starts on the street. Mm-hmm. The kids would have scanners. There's volunteer firemen kids. They'd all go running. The cops would come. What are you going to do? They're not my kids. Or the one next door. It's this one, that one. This went on and on and on and on. Finally, I go to court. I go to the local newspaper. It's presented. I'm told, let's get with the sheriffs, get some community service going on. That didn't pan out. These people who were underage drinking and their parents allowed it to happen are now 21. A lot of them are dropouts. Mm-hmm. They're still drinking. I have looked into things where I have seen in this rural community because of, I would have to actually admit favoritism. I know the cop, I know the judge, you know this and that. I have seen DWIs and underage drinking mm-hmm. just trashed like it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. I suffered for this greatly. I have been bullied because of it. I have been arrested and called I'm violent because of this. And I'm a good person. But because these people had connections and nobody cared, these people are still, they've been involved in burglaries in churches, cocaine. And then when I would call certain law enforcement to my house, they'd say, well, how do you know they're doing that? Well, when I see 60 cars across the street in the parking lot where there's no cars coming down the street after 8 o'clock at night, there's a problem. I'm told to call because if there's suspicious behavior, and then I'm told, well, there's policy and procedures mm-hmm. that we have to follow. Well, how come somebody doesn't go investigating? Okay, so now we get the tip line, and I think, wow, this is awesome. I can call confidentially, mm-hmm. or other neighbors can. Well, that was done, but when I saw that certain kids would still run and the one who's 21 is still there, and, well, I'm the only one drinking, you know, I don't know who else was here, they left. Well, isn't that person responsible for buying all that alcohol? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, nothing was done there. So I go to the local stores and I ask certain names. Well, these kids have fake IDs. Mm-hmm. This is a very tiny community. I'm new there, but I can see what's going on.
But, you know, I think you raise a good question. I mean, it's a lot about a lot of the enforcement, and we do have opportunities. You know, you have the enforcement folks here today. But, you know, those stores that are selling, you know, they are part of the tip line and do get investigated, and they lose their license to
but
do it.
The
so
thing
there's
is,
ways
the thing
to do
is
that.
This. I just want to hurry up because I want people to be really aware of uh-huh. what's going on. This is not right. It's not my duty to call the store. It's not my duty. I live across the street from uh-huh. a sheriff's station that was uh-huh. defunct. It was open, but nobody was ever there. I get the tip line, and I call. And this is not just the sheriff's. It had to do with the New York State Police, too, mm-hmm. and a social worker, mm-hmm. and the fire department, mm-hmm. and the justices. And I called tip line. A neighbor called tip line. They were partying all night long, real young. They could see it outside. I look at the police reports that I foiled from the sheriff's department. It said, oh, they claim that the lady that's crazy, she's just reporting things on us. Uh-huh. and she wouldn't give us her name. Mm-hmm. I thought the tip line was confidential. Mm-hmm. I remember calling, and I talked to some other people who said they demand to ask for the name mm-hmm. on the tip line.
Well,
that
you have
deters people mm-hmm. from calling. And so everybody stepped.
Well, it sounds like that's something, you know, to talk about locally today, about your, you know, what you can do about it. The other thing I would encourage you is also you have a story to tell. And on our website, we have IamRecovery.com. And the way we get rid of the stigma is to tell your story. So I would encourage you to do that, your personal story.
What's the email address?
Yeah. Oh, Sheriff Howard.
No, I think you've done a good job of demonstrating how important it is that what we're doing today is that we have a collaborative effort. That we get out the message that we care. I don't know when the specific incident occurred that you're making reference to or exactly where that mistake might have occurred, but we would recognize that where problems like this reoccur or that they do occur, that the supervisors, not just the sheriff, but my own police supervisors care about that. I think it's more important to look at where we are and where we're going than where we were. And again, to the importance of this and that our joint efforts of working here together with all the different law enforcement agencies, none of us are perfect, but all of us want to do better. And so we thank you for your time and for sharing that with us.
Good morning. My name is Jim Maney. I'm the executive director for New York Council on Problem Gambling. And I came out from Albany today because I wanted to see what this program looked like. And it's a wonderful program. And what we would like to do, the problem gambling field, is take a look at doing the same thing, underage gambling. So I really appreciate the time and the effort and what everybody's doing involved in this. And, Commissioner, that you do mention gambling every time you talk about something. So we appreciate that. I'll only be 20 more seconds. Problem gambling is also a large, large problem. And so if we could take a look at every time we're talking about underage drink and underage drugging, that we always take a look at underage gambling also. Thank you.
I got to add to that. It's very good that you pointed that out. And again, if our focus here is on underage drinking, but that we could see what works for drinking and apply it to other things, and actually other examples of that, I think we started, I don't know which was first, maybe the domestic violence court, maybe the drug courts that have gone on now to mental health courts, to gambling courts, to the veterans, to even the special courts to serve special populations. So it's a very good comment.
And we're seeing that, as many of you know, the parties, the Friday night drinking parties, you know, parents, some of the parents get that, you know, that they can't do that, but now the poker parties start. And the first poker party ain't a big deal, but when the kid starts taking money, you know what I mean, and what we've seen, you know, and we just had, you know, over the last year, a death in Long Island, 17-year-old kid, all gambling debt. The issues are the same, you know, when you look at it, you know what I mean, on what happens with the addiction. So we won't want to miss an opportunity to address it here. So, Jim, I'm glad you're here.
Commissioner and Sheriff, good morning. Thank you for being here and for your presentations. My name is Pete Hill. I'm the Health and Wellness Director at Native American Community Services here in Erie and Niagara Counties. I was at a meeting recently where we're among prevention providers, and we're talking about the underage drinking issue. And then somebody brought up that marijuana use is on the rise among young people in Western New York. Then somebody else brought up heroin and stuff. And each in that meeting, it was a small group, but each time we looked at, oh, what's this issue, and that's what are the needs here, jump to another substance, what's that issue, and what's that all about? And it seems like we're almost chasing the drug of the day almost kind of selection. And at our organization, instead of doing that, we're trying to find out, instead of what are people using, we're asking the question, why are we
Absolutely.
Using in the first place? Absolutely. So what we're looking at is impact of community history, community dynamics, historical trauma, and things like that. And when I was reading the OASIS prevention plan for till 2014, there was some discussion about cross collaborations between other programs and organizations. And because we're, and many other providers, are multi-funded, each funding organization has its own requirements for reporting, theory, program perspectives, prevention theory, and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about what you see as how we can improve the cross systems collaboration and looking at multiple issues rather than only focusing on alcohol or substance abuse?
Right. I mean, I think it comes down to, and you raise good points, you know, obviously, and we don't chase the drug, you know, and we don't chase the addiction. Addiction is addiction. You know what I mean? How they got there, you know, and what's happening is we know why, because of some of the environmental issues that happen in the community. What am I doing Friday night? You know, what are my friends doing? Do my parents care? You know, parents still, number one, You know, parents or significant caregiver, you know what I mean, are still the number one influence in their kids' lives. Number one influence. So what are we doing to educate the parents so they can educate the kids? Now, so we don't chase. You know, we talk about it. And, you know, like Long Island right now, they're all, you know, obviously it's all on the prescription drug abuse and what's happening. And when I show them the numbers, I said, yes, it's on the rise. But still, alcohol is number one. Do not miss that. You know, and turn your attention to the whys. And you made the point, and it's excellent, because that's usually my, you know, that's usually my comment. Look at the whys. So getting there, you look at the whys, and you do look at the other systems of care. And I think, did I mention it here, the Governor's Action Council? I think I mentioned it. The Governor put together an Action Council, Addiction Collaboration to Improve Outcomes for New Yorkers. And he said, you know what, it's no longer going to be just about, you know, the Commissioner of Alcohol and Substance Abuse and Gambling Addiction. It's about that crossover with the systems. So we looked at public education, public welfare, public safety, and public health. What are we doing? And so and what the governor said very differently, and this is tough, you know, so he went out 2 years ago with horrendous statistics, like 70% of the kids in foster care are there because of a substance-abusing parent. So Eureka, again, just like the 90% of the people that are in prison are there because of an addiction, it's not my responsibility, it's not the Commissioner of Child Welfare's responsibility, it's our responsibility. So the difference, and I think you're seeing now, is he's holding us both accountable to reduce that number. Very specific. You know, you've got 70% of the kids in foster care right now. Gladys Carrion, the commissioner of foster care. Karen Carpenter-Palumbo, the commissioner of OASIS. You, too, will come together and reduce that number. And those are the teams we have established. Now, when you have a multiple, you know, serviced agency like you have, you're in a great place to say, this is what I want to do with the money. And I'm not being facetious about it. This is the time, because there is no more money and because we are cutting it, we are all together, the commissioners of all those agencies, 20 commissioners, by the way, coming together, you know, for this one purpose. We're there to say, and I do it all the time, I call Gladys and say, Gladys, we got to move that money from here to there. Can you wave that rag? I'll wave this rag. And the answer, for the most part, is yes. So I'm going to encourage you to look at those funding streams and what you have to do with reporting and what you want to do, because you think it can have a greater, you know, intervention in those numbers, and tell us about it. Tell us about it. Don't keep it to yourself. Don't say, if I only could, because I'm telling you all right now, this is you only could. You can do it. You know, you can't do it without approval, because we need a state taxpayer dollars. We need to know where it is. But have the idea, 9 cases out of 10, we're going to say, go ahead. And you can do it legitimately, as opposed to just trying to do it on the side or sending the worker over there because you know there's a need and you feel clinically, you know, professionally responsible to do it. So I would ask you to look at those funding streams and give us a proposal, you know, because we are being held responsible. And that's different from, you know, Governor Spitzer and Governor Patterson, that they said it's no longer pointing fingers because we've been doing that for decades. No, that's a public health problem. That's not mine. That's a criminal justice problem. That's not mine. No, not now. It's our problem. And you've learned that on local level. We've learned that on a state level.
Oh, good morning again. Andrea Wanet with the Erie County Council for the Prevention of Alcohol and Substance Abuse. You mentioned in our earlier meeting that Marian DeChristopher was putting together a list or an OASIS list.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're referring to an evidence-based practice list, but I was just wondering kind of where you're at with that.
Sure.
Obviously, we have great researchers with Dr. Wieczorek,
sure,
and the
right,
you know, Center for Health and Social,
yeah,
Research, and I'm sure we'll make that list,
yes,
but I guess my question is where you're at with that, and two, are there some programs that we're not aware of that, you know, you could tell us today about that maybe, mm-hmm, we could contact,
sure,
someone in NASA or,
sure,
whatever?
Yeah. I mean, yes, yes, and yes. All right. The first is, you know, I think what I was talking about this morning is we're getting this, like, you know, repository of all the programs, so you can do that. Now, a lot of them, Marian, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of them are on our website already, but, you know, and we highlight them, but I don't think as coordinated as it needs to be. So that's, you know, note to self, I got to check the website and see what that looks like. But the other one that I talked about is what we're going to release by the end of the year. Where's Marian? Right, Marian, the end of the year? The prevention scorecard, which talks about every single one of those programs, evidence-based and not, because we got a third, a third, a third, right? So we're not going to eliminate anybody because they're not evidence-based, although we are going to, there's a big debate in the field, but we are going to push towards evidence-based because there's science behind it, you know? But the idea is we're going to offer those out with all these programs, and you know, and there's going to be like a report card on how we're doing. That's where you will get the retention numbers and the best practices, and the contacts are right there this is the program going on in Nassau. Here's what's going on in Erie County. Who can I talk to in Chemung County? I'm from Chemung County, by the way, so I love the twang when I come from Buffalo. I can always pick up Rochester, Syracuse, and Buffalo. So, you know, I love it when I come out here, you know, to hear that. And you have one, Sheriff, just so you know. And it's great. I feel right at home. But that's the ideal. And so by the end of the year, at the very least, hopefully we'll have more information up before then, but we'll have that, you know, blanket, and we'll release it to everybody. And when I say release it, we release it to all our constituency groups. We release it to the 1,550 providers we have. You know, we release it to, you know, the School Boards Association and the, Child Welfare Association. So it's pretty large now. And then we're going to encourage you, what are you going to do about it? You know, because if you've got something you want to offer, you know, you've got to make sure you make those phone calls, you know, and vice versa. If you see something, you know what I mean, in, you know, Monroe County that you want to, you've got to make that phone call. But our job is to give you the contact information to do that. And then, by the way, we're going to hold you accountable. If your score is 80%, we want you to go to 85. You know, how are you going to get there? Because bottom line, and I'm not very popular, you know what I mean, when I say this, but if you're not performing, you know what I mean, and you are not making the difference that you need to make, and it's gradual, it's not overnight. If you're not making that difference, we're going to take the money and we're going to give it to somebody who is. You know, that's what you do with limited dollars. That's what you do in your own household, right? You know, if you got to take the money where you need to spend it, and what's most crucial, I need to do the same thing. So, you know, I'm used to being attacked. The tobacco, you know, everybody loves me on the tobacco, you know. But it's the right thing to do. And our rates as a result, I mean, just as an aside, on tobacco, 92% of, 18% of New Yorkers smoke. 92% of those with an addiction smoke. So, you know, when we announced first in the nation, you know, to go tobacco free, I had so many bruises because people didn't, you know, they're going to not come to treatment. Well, we haven't seen that. Our treatment numbers are higher than they were last year, you know, and, you know, we're saving lives at the same time because likely the smoking over a period of time is what's going to kill, you know, the individual. So I thought we would be derelict in our duty if we didn't address both addictions simultaneously. So that's one of the examples that I'm going to use the same, you know, leading the way on evidence-based for prevention.
Hello, Lieutenant Schultz, City of Salamanca Police Department. Question I have is specifically relating to underage drinking. And within our community, we have a lot of underage drinking. And from a law enforcement perspective, we can go out there and give these kids appearance tickets for violating that law. They show up for court that day, they pay a $25 fee, and they walk out the door. Is there any way we can force these kids to get counseling or to strengthen the law?
Exactly what we want. And so we're, you know, in some places that's happening, we need to move forward with that. I mean, look at even in that, you know, we're behind the times a little bit. We're working even on the DWIs. You know, there's still people that kind of get the number 3 DWI and somebody says, oh, they've never gone to treatment. You know, so, you know, we're really, you know, trying to push, and I appreciate all the particular areas, and Marion will get them to talk with our counsel's office about, you know, to say, okay, $25, because this is drug court, right? We hold people accountable, all the courts that we have, $25 and mandatory participation in, you know, a program, a prevention program or something. That absolutely, we can do that. We just have to, you know, we have to start it, and then we mandate it. And I'm all okay for mandates, sir. Yeah.
You're doing great.
Okay, let's
do it. The Office of Court Administration in New York State has recommended both the Assembly and the Senate pass laws because one of the issues of doing the appearance tickets, and if the judge gives an additional sentence, such as going to counseling, going for screening, going for education, right now there's no law that allows the judge to enforce that actual action to happen. So be aware of this, and I'm sure that through these organizations, the Office of Court Administration, in fact, Judge Graber, who is very aware of this because he's the judge in Darien out in Genesee County and often gets underage drinkers because of all of the concerts and things of that sort at Darien Lake Park. And so the Court Magistrates Association is supporting this, the Office of Court Administration. But that's one of the problems, is that judges don't have any follow-through. What they're actually asking to do is so that the judge can suspend the license because you go to family court if you're under 16. So it's a 16 to 20-year-old, and one of the most important things to them in their lives is having their license. And that's what the power they want to be able to have to do is suspend their license until they can follow through with the sentence that the judge would impose in there. And so some of the reasons why judges do this is that they feel powerless because they get numbers and they can't follow through on things they'd like to have happen.
And one of the laws that we are trying to change right now is the drinking driver program is in the Department of Motor Vehicles. That will move over to OASIS to change the curriculum. And part of that is to be able to say, first time, right, first time, you must go. And so I, you know, I'll look at the bills myself. You know, they're not moving too quickly, so that's why they haven't come before me. But the idea is, you know what I mean, anything we can propose to change it, you know, we'll do that. And I'll look into that specifically to see, you know, what else we can do. It's a good idea.
Hi. My name is Brooke, and I work for Prevention Focus, and I work a lot with adult women in recovery. And I am fully in support of mandating treatment. The issue that I almost hate to bring up is a lot of the women I work with can't afford it, even if they have insurance, because independent health, you know, it provides a copayment for treatment, but it's like $40 a visit. And I'm sorry, but most of the women I work with can't afford $40 a visit if they have to go three times a week for treatment.
Right.
And I'm just curious what we're doing about that.
Yep. Two things. First of all, parity is coming. You know what I mean? And that's going to help us a great deal, because if you're, you know, the insurance company, and I come from the managed care world, right, and some of my background, and, you know, we've as a result of managed care, even though people think it's a bad word, the physical health status of New Yorkers has raised incredibly. You know, comparatively. Now it's time to focus on the behavioral health side. You know, we have this, we just did a, and I'll ask you to maybe, Patrick, get with her and get that information on independent health to our council, because he just put together a whole managed care forum to really raise these issues so we know specifically where the problems are. Now, pretty soon, in independent health, if they're going to charge you, you know, $40, or let's just say $10 to go get your pap smear, you know, they can only charge $10 to go have your outpatient visit. That's what parity is. So that's coming our way. And also with healthcare reform, I think we're going to get there, because it's mandated. You must provide. Now, I'd like to look into some of that specifically on the $40, because that's a little news to me. And I couldn't afford it, to be honest with you. You know, I couldn't afford to do that. And we have to find ways to be welcoming. But I also will tell you, you know, people's lack of their ability to pay is not why they're not going to be accepted into treatment. And I would put this out to all of you. If there is a provider in this county or any other, you know, that gets state funds and is not accepting someone because of insurance, I personally want to know about it, because I will pull their license overnight. Because if they accept any state money, you know what I mean, and Susan's here, you know, Susan Litzker's here, we've got our treatment, you know, program here. You get free of charge programming. That's part of you, me paying, right? The state of New York, your taxpayer dollars, putting the $60 million into this community. So there should never be a denial of that because of an ability to pay. Now, we will pressure people, and part of Patrick's job here is to make sure people are billing, you know what I mean, and getting the money in that they should. But never, never is anybody refused for a lack of ability to pay. And if that is happening, that is my number one issue, because it is against every policy and regulation we have. So, you know, that's one. And if that is, and you've got to bring those cases forward, you know. And I've got, by the way, a commissioner's mailbox that is, I think it's on, is it, somebody, Patrick, you got to give everybody it, because I can't remember it. But, you know, it's, I look at these every day. You know, I get about, you know, 20 or 30 messages a day. I do them myself, you know. And if there are particular cases, we'll investigate it. But overall, as a whole insurance company, you know, an insurance field, parity and healthcare reform coupled with our regulations are making a difference. And I think you're going to see a big change over the next 2 years.
It was a tremendous question. Actually, I'm kind of interested in the audience feeling, by show of hands, do we think that there's enough treatment facilities? How many think that there are enough? And how many think there are not enough? There are not enough treatment facilities. I don't know what that means to you.
Yeah.
I know that we here in our jail, probably once a week, someone will call saying that my son or my daughter, my nephew or niece was just arrested on a new drug charge, a possession charge. They were actually waiting to get into a treatment program, and they were going next week. I mean, I never really wondered or never wanted to believe that or think that maybe it wasn't true, but maybe it is, that in fact people can't get into the treatment facilities, and they can't. I mean, if you're saying that I need to go today. I don't need to go next week, but we so often hear that there's a delay. So if in fact that's true, maybe we need to do something about the delay to get into treatment.
Right.
And maybe that's because they were there once and they can't go back again until a certain period of time has passed.
Well, that's what, you know, that's, and Patrick, you can speak to the specific numbers, you know what I mean? Correct me when I'm wrong. We're at like a 92%, you know, fill level. I mean, we have the beds open. They're open. We have no waiting lists in Erie County. None. Pardon me? We have vacancies. So when those hands just went up, You know what I mean? I want, you know, Patrick will stay here and find out, because right now we're not utilizing all the beds we have. So in the budget, you know what I mean, people would like to cut the amount of beds in this county and others because they're not all utilized. Now, if there's a waiting period, like they're saying next week, that's also a problem. You know, and sometimes we do it with the beds. But I can tell you, you know, and Phil and Patrick and all and Susan, all the people here, if there's somebody that needs that immediate, now everybody can't go tomorrow, right? You know what I mean? But if there's somebody that needs that, they'll get it. And if they're not getting it, honest to God, I want to know about it. Because we are giving out $60 million in this community, $2 billion for the state. And if somebody is not getting treatment for their lack of ability to pay, or that it's 3 weeks down, you know, then we need to know about it. I mean, because that is not, I mean, you know, we do have beds open. We have outpatient slots open. We have beds open. You know what I mean? And they're not all being utilized. And that's interesting perception that we have. But, you know, those are the facts. I only operate on the facts. You know, and the facts are, you know, they're not 100% utilized. And they probably should be 120% utilized. So, you know, get that information forward. All of you who raised your hands, we don't have enough treatment beds. I want to know the specifics because the numbers don't show it.
Yes. Hi, Leah Ferletto. I'm with the Center for Health and Social Research. For those individuals who are taking advantage of the treatment facilities, what type of programs are implemented for the families and more specifically the children of those families? People who are substance abuse users. Mm-hmm. How important of an issue do you think it is for those children to get treatment, and what type of programs are being?
Huge. I mean, first of all, it's huge. Usually what I say is 2.5 plus million New Yorkers, because we've got the individuals and we've got all their families, you know what I mean, and friends and colleagues that are all part of this disease. We know that. One of the things, I just was in front of the National Federation of Al-Anon, right, and for New York. And it's interesting, which I couldn't believe, first time a commissioner has ever gone before Al-Anon. You know, that's mind-boggling to me. But the idea was, they asked me the same question, what are you doing, you know, for kids? And you know what, we're not doing such a great job. We're not doing such a great job to involve families. All our treatment programs have family programs, absolutely. But what we're not doing is going directly into, you know, the families that we know are at risk, right? We've seen the cycle. You know, and what are we going to do for prevention with that kid? Now, the idea is, when I'm talking about, just as an example, 70% of the kids in child welfare, you know, or in foster care are there because of the substance-abusing parent. You know, what we're doing now is working with, trying to get a clinic in every one of those DSS offices. So we do two things. We treat the mom, mostly in this case the mom, unfortunately, but we also, at the same time, get the kid a direct referral into the prevention program, you know, to learn about what's happening. We haven't done that in the past. So the good news is that we're starting to do more about it. You know, we've got some good programs and models out there that we have to continue on, but it hasn't been a focus historically, and, you know, I'm trying to make sure it is now. So any ideas, again, that you have on that, you know, the better off we'll be, because if you're doing something right, we extend it. That's what it's for. And those are the kind of the things you talk about today, too. Like, this is what I'm doing, you know, because even though you're all in Erie County and you think you know what each other does, when we do communities of solution and we talk about the numbers, we also learn some of the things your own colleagues that have known you know, some of the things, you know, they learn new things, you know. And I was at a program a couple of weeks ago in Community Solutions. They all got together and, you know, they went around the room, talked about what they did, and people have known each other for 10 and 15 years. And they were like, God, I didn't know you did that program. Well, why am I trying to do that program? That's a community of solution, to say, I'm not going to run the group, you know, for alcoholic girls, you know what I mean, or girls with an addiction. When you're doing it, I'm going to do the one on veterans. So we have more to go around. So that's a, you know, an efficiency of resources. So I think the same thing has to happen here.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. My name is Giselle Jackman. I'm the Director of Program Services at Prevention Focus Incorporated. And you know me because I sit on the statewide committee for prevention in ASAP.
Yeah.
And I have a question related to the action council that you mentioned. Agreed, system collaboration is critical. In the field of prevention, we know that early academic failure is one of the number one ways to identify a kid at risk of using, and probably family history,
right,
problem behavior,
right,
et cetera. And yet we fight every single day as prevention service providers against a whole nother system of bureaucracy, mm-hmm, to be able to have access to students at a time when we would be removing social barriers and, yep, learning barriers that would increase their capacity. What, if any, action is going on the Action Council, mm-hmm, to adjust that kind of collaboration so that providers, the services that are already available and being invested by OASIS, could be delivered in a place that, you know, already we have kids.
Sure. I mean, one of the things, and, you know, certainly you've got your, you know, your one of your superintendents here, so talk through some of that. Because, I mean, I hear it from the teachers and the school personnel all the time. How many things? It's just like the doctor. How many things you want me to get in and do a day? You know, how many assessments, how many screenings, how many things can we put together? So it is about the schedule sometimes. But the idea is also about the access. And what we're trying to do, you know, on a statewide level is to highlight, first is an awareness, because everybody gets in the panic, right, that they, you know what I mean, like, oh, here comes those people. They want to take more time away from the academics, and I have to make sure my kids are graduating. But one of the, what we, when we first did action, what we went to every, in state ed, same thing. Okay, Commissioner, what's your number one priority in state ed? You know, I got to graduate kids. Okay, all right, and I know half of them are drinking, and that's probably one of the reasons they ain't going to graduate. So here's how we work together. So that's where it first starts, right? If you're so worried about your numbers, and everybody is, you know, everybody's got accountability, this is where we first start, you know, by being aware of the numbers. The next is, what can we do about it? And we've got to all negotiate it. Sometimes in our field, we in prevention, you know, and in treatment, we say this is the only way to do it. This is the only way to do it. So we're not, you know, we're culpable too. You know, we got to back off a little bit and see what melds. And then the school district and the schools have to back off. And sometimes it comes down to building by building. The best way I know to do that is to start with the awareness and get that collaboration and begin to talk about it, you know, and just start. Maybe it's just one day. Maybe it's just one day for this particular school. But it makes a difference. And what we're trying to highlight statewide, frankly, is what we're doing, what many of the schools are doing, so you can use them as best practices. Because what do we all know? School superintendent folks talk to school superintendent folks. They get it. You know, they can talk how they did it, you know. And prevention folks talk to prevention. And when you're both together in a room, as you are today, you know, I bet you'll come up with what could be a best practice here. So, and you know, and then I start getting on the phone if doors are shut. That's what I do on a daily basis. You know, get on phones with insurance companies, you know what I mean, or schools, and why can't that happen, and what's the problem? But, you know, bottom line, it's all about relationships, what we learned, you know what I mean, you know, how to get along in kindergarten. It's all about relationships and showing each other success, you know. And the way we did action is we said, because what's your number one problem in education, and how can I help you? And here's my number one problem, the kids are drinking, so how can we come together to, you know, to better service? So the more facts, and that's why I gave facts out today, the more facts you go, it's not just the happy natural people doing prevention, you know, and it's not just the school people that are only worried about academic performance. When you operate on the facts, you say both of us can benefit, right? You look good, I look good, and by the way, we're saving a kid along the way and a family. Not such a bad day.
Last question before you move on to LBM.
Thank you. Kevin Ryan from Alden Central Schools. And I just wanted to say, you know, the prevention programs and the treatment programs in Western New York have worked with us, and they're phenomenal. So we're very grateful to them for all that they do for the schools.
Yeah.
But we need to find a way to support a couple of things. One is family support centers in our school districts.
Yeah.
I think we have models, very good models in Western New York for that. The other thing you talked about that we're utilizing at the college level is the you know, the I Decide programs you talked about.
Yeah.
We need to get those in the high schools.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to support those there with resources. Because as you said, again, you know, schools right now, we're talking about grades and nothing else. And we're missing the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do a better job with that. And be able to find resources to help those kids, mm-hmm. because until we deal with those problems,
right.
they don't care about academics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Did you say Albion? Did you say Albion School?
Alden. Alden.
No, I'm going to Albion. I'm going to Albion.
It's your next stop, okay.
Great. Thank you very much, everybody.
Commissioner. Mike, for whoever put this program together, you did a great job, because our next speaker, when we talked about where we're spending our money and how we're diverting our resources, that it be science-based is exactly the topic that we're about to hear. We will also tell you, Commissioner, to keep everyone else in the suspense. About an hour from now, we're going to hear about the parents' program. But I'll just suggest, for the sake of thinking now, maybe it should be called parental detention or parental extension. But she wants a nice name for it to give her that thought going back. But to our next speaker, Dr. William Wazorek, is the director of the Center for Health and Social Resource at Buffalo State College. Some of his prior experiences came as a senior research scientist at the New York State Research Institute on Addictions, where a few of his interests were the prevention of drunk driving and the epidemiology of substance abuse. Please welcome Dr. Wieczorek.
Okay, one of the things that, get my presentation up here, and slideshow, and we'll start at the beginning. That was a fantastic and highly energized talk from our commissioner, but she set the bar high for me in syllables per second. I can usually talk pretty quickly, but I'm not sure that I can actually get to that type of level. But I am going to say, you know, even before we start here, one of the things that I want to be able to, this actually will work, so I'll use this to point. I prefer to use the mouse to point, is that this presentation will be on the PX20 website. I also want to say, well, sit back, hold on. We're going to go through a lot of stuff in about 45 minutes. There's going to be, but I think it's useful when you're going through something like this, especially at the pace, to have some kind of overview of what the expectations are. So I'm going to talk about what I call alcohol basics. Now, again, as the commissioner said, everybody thinks they know either data or what people are doing and all of those kinds of things, and that's where we're going to start. So we're going to start at the basics. Then we're going to talk about alcohol and public health in general. Why? Because if the underage drinking problem is the underage drinking problem, but it's only a subset of the overall alcohol problem. And so trying to understand the scope of the overall problem and where underage drinking fits in tends to make a lot of sense. Then we'll talk a little bit more about the details of underage drinking statistics, the health impact and the cost of underage drinking, and a little bit about PX 2010. It's everybody's problem, underage drinking, and this initiative. Beverage alcohol. This is simple biology that many of you will remember from high school, but almost all the alcohol comes from fermentation, in which simple glucose is broken down in a solution with yeast to yield alcohol and carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide in beer comes naturally through the process. But alcohol is a very ubiquitous, that means common substance in nature. Bacteria and yeast can create alcohols. To get higher volume alcohol, such as what you'd have in liquors, you have to do distillation. Alcohol, and so I'm not going to show a distillation still, but you've seen that in things, everything from the Beverly Hillbillies to shows on how it's done on TV. So, yes, but alcohol tends to boil away at a lower temperature so that you can increase the percentage of alcohol in the liquor. An important thing, you know, who hasn't heard someone say, gee, I really wasn't doing so bad last night till I mixed my drinks? Well, typically when you're mixing your drinks, you're just drinking more, because a drink is a drink. It doesn't matter whether it's wine, beer, or wine cooler, or liquor. Alcohol and its biological effect of that ethanol is the same. It's based on the volume of pure ethanol that you drink, and to get the concept of a standard drink, the idea that approximately 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or one shot of liquor, whether you have it straight or in a mixed drink, I have the equivalent amount of alcohol, a little bit more than half an ounce of pure alcohol. This is a graphic representation of that. You can see that, you know, 12 ounces a can of beer, usually beer is about 5%. When your malt liquor is a little bit less than 12 ounces will equal a drink. But you can see standard table wine here at about 12% over to, you know, spirits, liquors, which are about 80 proof, 40% alcohol. So a drink is a drink is a drink. You know, so you get drunk and you cause problems, whether it's on alcohol, wine, wine coolers, liquor, or any mixture of the things in between. And we're talking about, you know, this whole spectrum of care, going from prevention all the way through treatment. But it's important, and in fact, Pete Hill had, you know, raised the question why people are doing these kinds of things. But one of the important things to point out is the difference between drinking, which we usually think of as alcohol consumption, which is usually sociocultural. You learned it somewhere. You got some in church, your parents drink, people in your neighborhood drink, people in your culture drink. It varies by culture. People in France and Italy and Spain drink differently than we do here in the United States because culture has an impact on what people do. But people drink
because at least initially, you know, they find it to be in some way reinforcing pleasurable. If you don't find drinking pleasurable, those people don't drink. You know, at least a third of the population don't drink every year. Alcohol is a central nervous depressant, which means that it can be used in the old days. You know, I think you might have seen this in an old cowboy movie. You gave them enough to drink, they passed out, they could pull the bullet, the arrow out, or whatever, that kind of thing. So it could be a simple anesthetic. But that underestimates the complexity of the kinds of impact that alcohol has. But part of that impact, even the pleasurable, is that it's reducing how well that you think. It's reducing some of your cognitive ability. You typically don't say, hey, I'm going to get drunk because I want to take that test. You're usually saying, I want to get drunk because I want to forget about the test I didn't do well on because I was drunk the night before I took the test. And that moves into the other kinds of two categories in which you get into medical and psychiatric diagnoses. Alcohol abuse, which is more a combination of hazardous use and problematic use. You're using it and it causes problems in your life. You're not fulfilling some of your main roles in life. You're using it in hazardous situations, such as repeatedly drinking and driving. But when you get to alcohol dependence, and alcohol dependence is the medical term now used of what we would typically in the old days describe as alcoholism. That's really a disorder. It's a compulsion. There's a difference between consumption, where people are in control making decisions, and dependence, in which it's a compulsive disorder. You have many complex effects that are happening then, especially on the brain's people might call the pleasure reinforcement system, dopamine. Dopamine is sometimes called the pleasure system. I don't like that because if it were just that, people would be trying to synthesize dopamine and take that. But we know that dopamine is involved in reinforcement. So it's this complex reinforcement system that gets out of control in addiction, as well as other neurotransmitter systems in the brain that happen. This is looking at addicted versus non-addicted brains. These aren't necessarily kids. There's not as much great evidence for kids because these haven't been studied as well yet. And some of the issues about how high the rates are haven't been recognized until relatively recently. But if you look at the brains here, and you'll see this is cocaine, methamphetamine, alcohol, and heroin, there's a similarity among all the addictions. On this side, this isn't an addicted brain. Where you see the red's good. It means that you have the normal level of dopamine receptors. On the addicted brain, you'll see there's only little tiny spots of red. It means the dopamine receptors are not present. Well, why? Because the alcohol use typically spikes dopamine, so the brain has adapted to thinking it's going to get something that spikes the dopamine up so it doesn't have so many receptors anymore. But what does that cause? That then helps cause things like craving, because now your brain and your body wants these things that it have become addicted to, and that's the compulsion part. It's the difference between being in charge when you're just drinking socially versus what true addiction is. And this is what this is the problems that treatment has to deal with. There's real underlying physiological issues going on here. All right, we're giving you this big, you know, alcohol 101 here. And this goes from literally basically the end of Prohibition. Oops. And I'm going to go back, I hope. Oops. There we go. I'll try not to do that again. Okay. This goes from the end of Prohibition right up to almost about the present. One of the things that people have seen me say this before, over the last few years, the government stopped making useful information so readily available. And so there's data that shows that alcohol consumption, and this is total per capita. That means for every man, child, and woman in the United States age 14 and older, this is how much pure ethanol has been created for consumption. And where the numbers are now, it says about 2.2 gallons. It's closer to about 2.3 and going towards 2.4 gallons. You can see during this time here, what's this big lump here? Why is there high consumption here between, say, the mid-60s and about the late 1980s, mid-80s? Where did they come from? That's the baby boom. So when the baby boom started, you had lots of more young drinkers. This is already identifying that young drinkers tend to drink more. You had a lot higher per capita consumption. We then had a decrease, and it's going up again. But now you think this. Does this make any sense? How do you translate this? Well, 2 gallons of alcohol is about how much alcohol? I'll make that easy for you. It's 128 ounces for a gallon, 256. So it's over 256 ounces of alcohol. Remember how many ounces of alcohol are in a single drink? About a half. So if you take the 256 and double it, and actually know it's closer to more 300, you double it, you get about 600 drinks per person in the entire country every year. That counts for the people that don't drink at all. So the average amount of alcohol created is one heck of a lot. I'm going to suspect that a few people in here got their 600 drinks last year, but most didn't. It means that some people are drinking a heck of a lot more because many people don't drink at all. So that's an important thing to think about, and back on there too. Underage drinkers consume about 17% of alcohol. That's quite a bit of the alcohol. Underage drinkers, the proportion of the population between 14 and 20 is not 17% of the population. It's a little bit less than that. All right, so now we're moving on to overall health impact of drinking, because there's a controversy. Who hasn't heard about the wonders of red wine and cardiovascular disease? Okay, everybody's heard about that. Everybody's heard about that a whole lot, because there's a whole industry that's pushing that, quite frankly. There's some recognition of the acute types of impacts. Acute things are like crashes. Everybody hears about drunk driving crashes. You think about, well, chronic illnesses. What's the chronic illness that comes to mind for alcoholism? Cirrhosis, exactly. Cirrhosis is alcoholism accounts for the majority of cirrhosis. So you've got long-term effects as well as short-term effects here for alcohol. But how can we assess the overall effect? How do you weigh off those potential good benefits versus the problems? Well, public health has struggled with this problem quite a bit since the end of World War II. And over the last 20 years, they developed a methodology exactly to measure what's overall public health. Because is it how long people live? Is it your infant mortality rate? Is it how well people live? Well, they've come up with a measure that includes all of those things. The methodology is called the burden of disease method. It's a universal measure of public health of populations. It counts up the disability-adjusted life years. They're called dailies, which are the basic measure in this measure of overall public health. But what it does is it adds up the years of life lost. So it takes into account life expectancy. So if you die from something when you're 8 years old versus 80, it has a different impact. You lost, 72 years of life versus maybe none if you were used 80 as the life expectancy. But it also counts up the years that you live with some form of disability. Think of that as any kind of disease and illness. And there's also measures of adjusting for how severe. For example, if you're quadriplegic versus you have psoriasis, those are different conditions. They have some impact, but the quadriplegia has quite more impact. So there's a measure now of overall health. This wasn't created just for the alcohol and drug people. This was created for all public health in general. This is a very recent paper. It was published in The Lancet just in 2009 by Jürgen Rien, a colleague up at the University of Toronto. It looks at the burden of disease and injury attributable to alcohol use. What are some of the, and this is, and over time, as we even learn more, there'll be new illnesses that come onto this. But this is just to give you an idea of how many different illnesses that are associated, such as cancer. In very many things, such as esophageal cancer, there's a direct association with alcohol consumption. Neuropsychiatric illnesses, such as depression, epilepsy, people don't recognize. If you're in the treatment field, you recognize that seizures are something that's not uncommon in people that have addictions. But if you're not in that field, you might not recognize that. So epilepsy and seizures are often associated with addiction kinds of problems. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease. Now, in these two, you can have both a little bit of a positive impact as well as a negative impact. And so this methodology we're talking about takes both of those things into account. Because what's known is that small amounts of alcohol tend to be protective cardiovascularly. Once you get to large amounts of alcohol, it's not protective and becomes a risk factor again. Gastrointestinal illnesses, a variety of other kinds of illnesses. But this also makes alcohol different from most other kinds of risk factors are these acute things, unintentional injuries and intentional injuries. And we'll see a lot more about that here. All right. I'll do this and try to make a relatively complex table easy. We look at the total here. These are the total of the dailies, which is the measure of the health impact of alcohol, added up here all over the world. This is the entire world amount here. You'll see there's intentional injuries, unintentional injuries, all of these kinds of things. And these are the negative impacts. And they add up here to a number that's 73,000, but you actually multiply that by a number of thousand to get the correct answer. Then in this white section here, this is taking into account the beneficial effect of alcohol. So it's subtracting out. There's a little beneficial effect, so you lose some of those dailies, and there's a little bit higher beneficial effect for cardiovascular disease. So then the overall, but when you look at this, what's the overall beneficial effect? Somebody wants to read that number out loud for me. Can you read it as it is? Any volunteers? 2321. What's this number here? Okay. The ratio of those are about, it's not 3 to 1. It's a ratio of 30 to 1. So for every positive benefit that you get from alcohol, there's 30 problems. That's a big, it isn't that alcohol is like, it's even, oh, it's a little bit that alcohol causes more problems or that alcohol saves more. No, it's a big differential. And then but here comes another question. It's 4.6% of all the dailies worldwide. Well, is that a big number or a small number? We'll look at some comparisons. But one thing to note here is that the last time this was done was 2000, and this is 2004 data. There's been a substantial increase in alcohol's effect worldwide negatively over the last half of a decade. A lot of that has to do with alcohol in developing countries. So how does alcohol compare with other kinds of risks? So we know that alcohol in net has a bad risk. But compared to other kinds of risk factors, is alcohol, 20th on the list, 5th on the list, 1st on the list? Where does alcohol fall as a risk factor? So here's some citations, and Azadi is one of the fellows who has done this kind of comparison using the global burden of disease model. This report's on it, the World Health Report. Ed Wedding and Yasmin Saeed published a paper in a statistics journal that looked at this for North America. But it compares risk factors by examining what predicts these dailies. All right. When you look at the world, you need to think of the world in different places. The developed world, for example, places like Africa, people are starving. They don't have access to clean water, clean food, etc. So when you look at what are the effects on health, they're going to be very different in different parts of the world. So we're looking at our part of the world. This includes most of Europe, this includes North America, parts of South America, etc. We're the developed regions of the world. And when you look at this, where are we worldwide? Tobacco is number one as a risk factor for bad health. High blood pressure is number two. Alcohol is number three. Another thing to point out here is, where's all those... Oops, I keep touching that. Went in the wrong direction here. Where's all those illicit drugs? They're combined. All of the illicit drugs cause substantially less than alcohol. Alcohol is a huge problem. Now, what else do you notice about this? What color do you see in this bar that you don't see in the other bar so much? Green. That's what makes this very different, because the acute effects of alcohol, you don't have to be dependent. You don't even have to be an abuser. You can be just have one episode where you overdrank and you have the risk of falling into these acute kinds of things. And what are they? These are intentional injuries. That's homicides. Those are suicides. Those are violent kinds of episodes. These are unintentional injuries, falls, burns, car crashes, drownings, etc. So a large proportion of the effect of alcohol is an acute effect. It means short term, doesn't have to build up. That's what makes this an especially interesting problem. Most of these are psychiatric effects as well as some cancer and cardiovascular. But now about North America. This is as close as the data we have for the United States. In North America, we're looking at all risk factors, and tobacco is the biggest one. Remember, we looked at those kinds of reasons. We're not usually that concerned that, hey, the kids are going to go out, they're going to smoke a cigarette, they're going to crash their car, they're going to die. Whereas in tobacco, or whereas in alcohol, that tends to happen. So the second leading risk factor for burden of disease in North America is alcohol. So somewhere between the second and third risk factor across the entire developed world for all premature mortality and all disease mortality is alcohol. You also want to point out, you got high BMI, high blood pressure, high cholesterol that are coming down in here. Most of our problems in the developed world are things that are behaviorally mediated. We tend to use the word behavioral medicine only for addictions and mental health, but it cuts across all other kinds of major illnesses, such as cardiovascular disease, high BMI, etc. We have much to offer to those areas of medicine because they haven't thought about how to try to convince people to do things in their own best interest, which is about what our field is focused on. Okay, so this is the overview of the health impact. Highly detrimental. Ratio of bad health to good health effect, 30 to 1. Not close. Not even a little bit close. Tobacco and alcohol are the first and second leading risk factors for burden of disease in North America. The per capita consumption is increasing again in the United States after going down from the late 80s and through the late 90s. Alcohol accounts for 3 times more disease burden than all illicit drugs combined. I'll let that sink in again. All illicit drugs combined account for only one-third of the impact of alcohol. So, what drug is the favorite drug of teens? Of course, it's alcohol. Why? Because it's cheap, it's readily available, it has impacts. Oops, I keep doing it. There we go. You can see, and this is, I've mixed up a variety of different sources on this. This one is from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. There's some that's going to be from Monitoring the Future. There's some going to be from the Youth Behavior Risk Factor Survey. The point is, I'm not cherry-picking these. You can go to lots of different data sources. You're going to find similar patterns. You're going to find some changes over these patterns over, say, the last decade. You're not going to find huge changes over these patterns, especially when it comes to the effect of and the role of alcohol. So alcohol, this is last month. So we'll be looking at last month here. You know, for 12 to 17-year-olds, these are pretty young underage drinkers. You're talking 6th, basically, to 12th grade. 16% of them reported drinking in the last month. Only 6 or 7% marijuana or hash use. And when it comes down to non-medical use of basically prescription drugs, this is still about the number that they just reported in the newspaper yesterday, about 3%. That number's higher than it was. We've put a lot of focus over the last 10 years on inhalants, but now we're seeing that this prescription drug use is about three times more prevalent than inhalants. But alcohol is the number that's way up there. Let's do some more about the favorite drug of teens. Compared to cigarettes and marijuana, more kids use alcohol. And now we're looking at, and this is from Monitoring the Future, where they look at 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. You can see the numbers are relatively low in 8th grade, yet they're already existing. You know, and this is past month use, not whether they've used it at all in their life. You'll see the numbers get higher then. But here's the alcohol in 10th grade. And you can see that the difference between alcohol and marijuana, or alcohol and marijuana and alcohol and cigarettes has even grown. And then by the time you're into 12th grade, you've got almost half the students reporting using alcohol in the last month, whereas you've got about less than one in five students using marijuana. The big problem is it's not just that they're using, they tend to use to excess. Compared to older persons, younger persons drink more per occasion. So here's 12 to 20-year-olds who say they're drinking, on average, fewer than six times a month. When you get to everyone over age 26, we drink more frequently. It's almost nine times a month. But here's the difference. This is the number of drinks per occasion. For the 12 to 20-year-olds, they're drinking what we typically consider to be binge drinking, which would be five at a time. They're doing that as their average drinking consumption. That's saying they're getting to impairment, which gives the high risk of acute types of problems. And you can see that there's still the usual number of drinks here is substantially less. It's about, you know, between two and three drinks for older populations, whereas those younger kids are drinking more. You know, it's not that they're drinking one or two. So it's sort of that myth of, gee, if we can just get kids to drink one or two, they have an attraction to drinking in this kind of way. This also looks at the drinking to assess basically across the entire lifespan. But there's issues to remember that, you know, the 40-somethings and the 50-somethings that are drinking in this way aren't just learning how to drive. They also are likely to be drinking in very different situations. They're likely to be drinking over longer periods of time, etc. When you look here, you're looking at 14, 15, and we look at 14 through 18. By the time you get the 17 and the 18-year-olds, you're looking at them saying they're basically getting drunk every week, four times a month. That's like every weekend means they're getting drunk. That's a lot of exposure. Even the younger drinkers are getting drunk a couple times a month. Another adolescence drink to excess to reinforce this. Ever used in your lifetime, you're up to about 75% by 12th grade. Been drunk at least once by 12th grade? The majority of kids say they've been drunk at least once. Then drunk in the last month in 12th grade, you've got about 35 to 40% of the kids saying they got drunk last month. This isn't just it's only happening a little bit, etc. There's quite a bit of it. What about underage drinking rates? This is from a report that was just released in April 1st of this month. And it shows that this area of the country, we have some of the highest rates of underage drinking, about 32 to 40%. But it isn't evenly distributed. It's another one of those things of some other kids are doing this. No, the highest drinking rates are actually among white kids. Lowest drinking rates are among Asians and African Americans. Yet, their drinking is still relatively high. So there is variation. Girls tend to drink less than boys, but they're still pretty high numbers. But there is variation between ethnicity groups. But the issue is that when you see something like this, you can't say, it's not in my backyard, it's somewhere else. No, this is the stuff in your backyard. Well, how much it is in your backyard? What about if we look at some data that's local? This is the ninth grade survey, so a relatively young group, done by the by Roswell Park. They do this every several years, and that just did that again. Okay. But when you look at drink alcohol ever, you got about half of them drinking ever, and you have about almost a third, between 25 and 30%, drinking in the last 30 days. And the majority of those who drank in the last 30 days, 16 out of the 28, said they got drunk last month. And again, the numbers are higher than marijuana use and other drug use, to remind that. This is everybody's problem. This is our backyard. This isn't somewhere else in the country. This isn't some other ethnic group. This isn't some other age or gender group. These are our folks. So let's look at alcohol and its effect on adolescent health. Acute health impact is disproportionately towards the young. Even without alcohol, young kids aren't great at making decisions. We all know that. Anybody in a school district know how hard it is to convince kids to do, quote unquote, the right kinds of things. But falls, crashes, violence, suicide are among the most frequent causes of death. Alcohol use disorders also account for a very substantial health impact in this group, which I'll go into in a few slides down the road here. So what are the main causes for death for adolescents? And these are 15 and 19-year-olds. Unintentional injuries, things we're talking about, crashes, falls, etc. Homicide and suicide. Now, when you look at how big these bars are, here's where you get down to the things that you typically think about health. You know, we think about, my God, look at that problem, and it is. I mean, because we all have known people, and it is a difficult problem. And we take it very seriously. Look at the problem of cancer in adolescents. But when you look at what are killing our kids, it's not cancer that often. We want to fight cancer, but do we put the same effort in fighting these kinds of causes of death as we do in cancers and some cardiovascular disease? No. We dwarf those causes of death with this kind of injury death. And what kind of injuries you're talking about? Motor vehicle crashes, firearms, poisoning. What are a lot of those poisonings? Those are both your accidental overdoses, in which you probably have about 1,000 of those across the country each year on alcohol. And those are also your suicides. Those are suicides by and large, or what those suffocations are, and drowning. It's also not good to swim when you're drinking. Even such things as how you dive into a pool or a body of water, you tend to dive more deeply. You're more likely to break your neck and then drown because you were drinking, rather than if you're sober when you're doing things like that. Here are some of the background in alcohol and fatal crashes. You can see that there's not many 15-year-old drivers. This is the number that are killed each year. These are 2008 statistics, so they're as new as we can potentially get here, by and large. But you can see as percent they'd have some alcohol on board. Even these 16- and 17-year-olds, you're about 1 in 5. By the time you get to 18, 19, and 20, you're up over 35%. So somewhere in the range of about a third of all the fatalities of underage drivers is because of underage drinking. How about other kinds of adolescent injury death? You know, what proportion are those? About 38% of all unintentional injury deaths are associated with alcohol. That includes drowning, burns, falls, etc. I got this data from something you can look up, Reducing Underage Drinking and Collective Responsibility. There's tons of resources out there, and I have many of the websites in one of the handouts that you have in your folder today. But this is where these data come from. And the alcohol involvement in intentional injury, about over a third of homicides have alcohol on board. Alcohol is known in an experimental setting to increase violence. It especially increases violence where people are somewhat prone to violence to begin with, but it definitely increases violence, been shown experimentally, and it's associated with homicides and all kinds of violent crimes. About 12% of suicides for males and about 8%, so somewhere around 10% or so of all suicides are alcohol-related. Actually, as you get a little older, the alcohol impact for suicide even increases. So you're looking nationwide at least 300 suicides and at least 1,500 homicides. So these aren't small numbers. Now, this is part of the change. When I first got involved in this field, I always thought that the goal of prevention was basically getting kids to survive adolescence. But over approximately the last 10 years, and especially the last 5 years, when we've done better epidemiology on how do you assess alcohol dependence and other kinds of drug diagnoses, we've learned quite a bit that actually alcohol dependence is considered to be a developmental disorder. Look at what the age where people start drinking. This is here the percent they ever report in their lifetime by report. This is done in a very careful epidemiologic way. This is the National Epidemiologic Survey on Alcohol and Related Disorders. Over 40,000 people were in this. Over 26,000 of those people were drinkers. This is the age they said they started drinking. There's a very careful assessment for alcohol use disorders in this. If you start at 14 or younger, it's about 50-50. 47 and 45% ended up having a lifetime diagnosis. They tend to get it relatively quickly, means relatively young before age 25. Even if you go up to age 17 here, you know, that's 28%. But clearly anything starting under the age of 16, you have at least a third or more who develop addictions. That's an overwhelming number. You know, so if this isn't just about the acute effects, this is also about the addictive effects. And by doing environmental approaches, and we can drive this age up, we can prevent some of this addiction, is what one would expect from these kinds of data. But also shows that they're more likely to have a diagnosis currently, and that the percentage they have more severe. You have multiple kinds of episodes. Same data set. And this is looking at the age group. So the age groups were 18 to and older for the NESARC study, the National Study of Alcohol, National Epidemiologic Study of Alcohol and Related Conditions. And when you look, where's the highest rate of current? This is in this last year that they have enough symptoms to be alcohol dependent. 18 to 20 year olds and 21 to 24 year olds had tremendously higher rates than everyone else. This is really, in my opinion, big news. We're not seeing these numbers, I think, in most of our treatment, because a lot of parents, families, schools, et cetera, say, alcohol, he's having some problems with that. Oh, involved with drugs? Now we want to do something about it. But this is really identifying that alcohol dependence is part of developmental trajectory difficulties that are happening between the transition from adolescence to adulthood, that the influence of an actual substance like alcohol that can influence the brain and can lead to addiction is having a tremendous impact, both on an acute and on an early chronic way, because many of these people will continue to have alcoholism-related issues as they age in the population. Okay, what are we looking at here? More kinds of... Is alcohol just alcohol, or what are those drinkers also involved in? This is actually from the National Adolescent Health Study, another huge study that has great measurement that's been done. This is reported by OJJDP, which is the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. All right, so you're looking at in a relatively young age group. This is your 6th graders to 12th graders approximately. 23% drank alcohol. That goes with the other numbers. Okay, so among those who drank alcohol, 32% used marijuana. Among those who didn't drink alcohol, only 2% used marijuana. You know, there's a 15-to-1 higher odds ratio of you using marijuana if you've already used alcohol. You know, so going one of the things, you know, what Pete Hill was mentioning before, some of the reasons we've looked for drug of the month or new things to focus on is that we have this big alcohol problem we haven't done very well with. And by dealing with this alcohol problem, we can help deal with some of these other kinds of issues too, such as other drug use. Now, that's not to say that alcohol makes you do this. It's a complex kind of thing with exposure. But it's clear if you don't have the exposure and the use to alcohol, you're much, much, much less likely to use other drugs. Because marijuana is the most frequently used other drug. Everything else is less frequent than that. What about, and all right, law enforcement is here. Any alcohol involvement in crime, especially with underage drinking? Nah. I'm just checking to see if anybody's still listening or whether they put you to sleep with all these things here. Yeah. But clearly, you know, when you look at those who drank alcohol, oops.
Again, I did that.
When you look at those who drank alcohol versus those who didn't, you know, especially in this younger group, 37% said they vandalized property. That's one of the reasons why we'd like to look at measures of criminal mischief. A lot of that criminal mischief stuff that happens, stop signs ripped down, houses that get painted, things that get egged, windows that are broken on your cars, windows that are broken on your house, they're done often by drunk kids, quite frankly, drunk and drug kids. But where's the other things that we would expect? Associations with attack and assault. Violence, not a shock. You know, there's a biological impact that alcohol helps enhance being violent. So, you know, being suspended from school, you're more likely to be suspended from school. But this is, you know, helps highlight the link between criminal behaviors and drinking. What about drinking in school? And I'm going to say something. There's less about drinking and its effect in college than there is about drinking and its effect in the earlier grades. But this is from the Youth Risk Factor Behavior Survey, and this is actually from the this is also from the National Academies of Science report. But when you look, this is never drank category. They drank, but they never drank more than five. This is they drank more than five drinks at least one time, two times, three to five times, et cetera, six times. What happens is, who tends to get A's most frequently? Gee, the kids that didn't drink. The kids that drank a little bit, they're still relatively high. When you get down here by drinking a lot, their grades mostly A's aren't all that common. Well, who tends to fail? Very rare among the never drank kids and among those who may have just tested out. But you're starting to get, you know, 10% and 5% of the kids who are saying their usual grades are D's and F's. Based on drinking relatively frequently. So you can see this direct association with school performance, direct association with crime, direct association with just about all the bad things that can happen to adolescent kids. Adolescent and brain and its effect on the brain. This is one where I think we need to be careful. There's reasons to believe there's going to be an effect. However, we have much more data on the effect of alcohol on adolescent rat brains than we do on adolescent human brains because they're much more hard to study, the adolescent humans. But we know that adolescence is a time of major brain development. Because things are changing your body, you're at a special risk to interfere with that developmental process. That development of what's called executive functions, decision-making, the prefrontal lobes, they don't develop fully, especially for males, until after age 25. That tends to be associated with more risk-taking in general as well as impulsive kinds of decision-making. This isn't to say adolescents can't make good decisions. They can't, but this is one of the reasons why it's hard to get them to make good decisions on a really regular basis, and that many times they don't make good decisions because their brains are not yet fully wired to actually improve their decision-making. We also know that adolescent brains react differently to alcohol. For example, they tend to say they enjoy the mood effect of alcohol more than older people do. And there's actually underlying brain reasons for that. But they're also even less sensitive to the aversive impact. Why? Because they're young and they're healthy. They're less likely to have a direct liver type of problem. They're actually less likely to have a hangover once they've started drinking compared to people that are older. So they're not getting this negative feedback about their drinking, and they tend to like it a hell of a lot. And they're wired to like it that kind of way. So this is a difficult issue to deal with. And there's that potential direct impact on brain structure. That's especially true for those who have alcohol dependence. However, and we know, we have very good data, that trying to use scare tactics actually doesn't work and it tends to backfire. We don't have data to say, don't have that drink with dinner with your family with a little bit of wine because you're going to screw up your brain for the rest of your life. There's no evidence to support that kind of use of this information. We know that it's a risky time. We know that alcohol can, again, interfere with brain function as well as brain development, and it's especially true for those who fall into the addiction category, of which nearly a third will because of the early drinking. Are you saying 2 meters or 2 minutes? I'll probably take a minute more than 2 minutes, but I'm seeing it because I got about five up there. But this is now saying all the stuff happens. What's the cost? Cost in New York State, and you can go to this website and look it up for every state. The cost in New York State is $3.5 billion every year. About $1.1 billion are direct costs. So if you want to say, hey, pain and suffering doesn't have any cost, it's not important. Whoa. Even if you just get to the direct cost, you're talking about over $1 billion a year. Where's the cost on these? Again, violence, crashes, crime, injuries, they're the majority of the cost. There's other important costs there, treatment, FAS issues with young mothers, property crime, high-risk sex and pregnancies, etc. So but still, the biggest ones are violence and injuries. What's this again? Back on our local level here in Erie County. That estimated cost is for $1,802 for each adolescent. Well, we've got about 118,000 youth between the ages of 13 and 20 in Erie County. Multiply that by that $1,800, you get a $200 million cost per year. Even if you just look at the direct costs, which are about 35%, you're looking at a $70 million cost per year in Erie County all alone. Oops. All right. Where do kids get their alcohol? We're one of the states that has the highest rates of purchasing, which is only between 10 and 18%. That means that over 80% of the kids get their alcohol not by buying it in a store, but by getting it in some other way. And the way that they're getting it is often through parents, guardians, family, friends, members. Got it from somebody who's 21 and older, and especially once you get older, you know people that are 21 and older, so that becomes more frequent. Got it from some other kid, or they took it from their house. You know, this, again, highlights that it's everybody's role. This is from the Surgeon General's report on underage drinking. And it looks at what are all the influences on kids, parents, families, community, culture. We have things like schools or peers and our policies and laws that overlap. And these policies and laws can overlap at school. These are the kinds of things that we're starting to want to focus on. But it highlights that underage drinking really does impact everybody. It impacts health, impacts families, crime, addiction, illicit drug use, school performance. If you're a taxpayer, you're paying some of these costs. You can't help pay some of these costs. Impaired driving, suicide, etc. It's an amazing story about how big the influence is. So as PX 2010 is this initiative that's our initial response. It's not the only response. It's not going to be the only response. But when you're starting out, where might you want to start out? You want to start out on looking at where you can have the biggest impact. So the group from px20.org, and you can go there. They were going to have this entire presentation up on the website. So you'll be able to download it there. It's a collaborative effort. It's been put together over a number of years by a cooperative group effort led by Erie County Department of Mental Health to develop a comprehensive prevention plan. And the folks on alcohol, because it's the most commonly used drug, has the largest health impact, especially because of its impact on adolescents and young people. And the approach that we're talking about, again, this is not the only approach, but how hard is it to convince kids to change their behaviors? It's exceedingly hard. One of the ways to actually have impact is by changing the environment, changing access, changing rules, changing parents' norms about things like hosting parties. It's not as rare as one would think. So it's that recognition, as Commissioner Palumbo said, without recognition, you're not going to do anything. So it's recognizing that it is everybody's problem. It's a focused community-level response. These responses across community are called environmental prevention. It's a universal population. We're not trying to change individual kids. Here we're trying to change the environment that kids are in, including by impacting on their parents, impacting with law enforcement collaboration with schools, and how to focus that impact through the school system, in which you're going to hear a talk by Superintendent Raby in just a minute or two. But we want to create policy changes in schools, especially for schools to have things like the mandated parent education programs, to change norms and behaviors by providing that information to schools and to parents. Many parents are unaware of this. The kinds of things that went through, many alcohol researchers, public health professionals are unaware of. But we want to decrease youth access, and we're dedicated to measuring this. Right now, our staff, and I want to give my staff a lot of credit, because in between all the other work, they've taken on the effort of getting a survey in the field to get some baseline data, whether people have heard about this, what they think about alcohol versus other drug kinds of problems in our community, et cetera. And we're out doing that survey, so we got baseline data before we're doing this, and we can do follow-up work in the future. So we're committed to doing things like raising the initial drinking age, getting more schools having programs, reducing access, and being able to measure whether people are aware of these kinds of things. And being only a minute or two late, we're done.
Just stay here a second.
I want to thank you. It's very good for all of us to know that there's that much statistics out there about this problem, but I would like to just ask this one thing, and I think many of us have been faced with the same thing, is that when talking to parents about discouraging the underage drinking, one of the biggest burdens for us to overcome, the parents would routinely say, well, in other countries, European countries or Arab countries, where they use alcohol, particularly wine, as a source of liquid, they don't have the alcohol problems there. So maybe our problem is that we don't start kids drinking soon enough. How do we respond to that?
I think that's been a difficult area to respond to by prevention for quite some time. However, you know that our laws in New York State allow a parent to drink with their kid. So if you want to Do this with your child. You have every right to do so. And if you want to try to teach them these things, you can, but you need to be aware of your kids aren't growing up in Europe. They're growing up here in the United States, and that it is illegal for you to do this with other people's kids. So you have the right to be a very good parent, yet you need to recognize that even the best parent you can be, your kids live in this environment. They're going to be exposed to these risks. And so if you're starting down that path, you should recognize that it's not going to be an easy path. It's a very risky path, and there's a lot of potholes in the road. But you can do what you want with your own kid. You can't do that with anybody else's kid, though, too.
Thank you very much. I think that... A number of people asked and said that this is as long as they can sit down. I think that in the interest of keeping our program going, but also in the interest of your circulation, we'd invite you to stand up for the next 3 minutes while we watch a video. If you don't want to stand for it, you don't have to. Maybe we'll continue to stand for just a couple minutes thereafter. But I think we have a video ready to show from many of you. Remember our Gil Kurlikowski, who was the former Buffalo Police Commissioner, who has now moved on to, I guess, his new title, if I can find it. Actually, we know him as a drug czar. Usually we think a drug czar is somebody we want to get a wiretap on. That's the people that are the drug kingpins. But, in fact, his office is in Washington now as the director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. So if we're ready to run the video, if you want to stretch your legs while we're watching it, please do so. The applause was very appropriate, not so much for Director Kurlikowski, but for what he acknowledged in that tape. It's not often that people say that people from Buffalo or Western New York are ahead of the curve. But as was acknowledged just in this tape video, as well as by Commissioner earlier this morning, it is coming increasingly apparent that this is one example where here in Erie County in Western New York, we have got ahead of this problem. We are coming out somewhat as a leader across the country, or certainly across New York, and most definitely here in Western New York, that we are coming out as a leader, getting out ahead of this problem. My name is Tim Howard. I'm the sheriff of Erie County. Actually, I'm closing in now on about 38 years of law enforcement. I began my law enforcement career in the village of Gowanda, a police officer, short time in the town of Eden. 24 years with the New York State Police, 8 years as Pat Gallivan's undersheriff, and a little more now than 4 years as the sheriff of Erie County. As was said before, my very clearly a part of a law enforcement family, besides the camaraderie and the closeness we feel within the badged professions, my three brothers were all law enforcement agent officers here in Western New York, and we're very happy now that between my sons and daughters and nephews and nieces, we have 10 of our next generation that are wearing different law enforcement uniforms here across New York State. But actually, since becoming a police officer, I've signed on very early and very early realized that I had a passion for enforcing or looking or addressing the underage drinking problem. And I did a little soul searching to try to find out where it is. And for the people of Gowanda, some of the older people that are here from Gowanda may, in fact, remember this. But it was actually a cold winter night, probably the late 70s, maybe early 80s, in which there was a report of two teenagers, a brother and sister, actually, from the Perrysburg area that were missing and long overdue from home, but no idea where they were. But given the weather conditions, we got very concerned, and with a multi-agency response involving law enforcement from Gowanda, from the state police, and from the Cattaraugus County Sheriff's Office, we determined that these brother and sister, I think they were 15 and 16, had attended an underage drinking party in Dayton, New York, into Cattaraugus County, and that they wandered away from that party and decided that the only way they were going to get home was to walk the railroad tracks. And as they walked these railroad tracks through a very remote area, first one and then the other actually passed out. So both of those kids were found asleep in snowbanks after being hot, for whatever reason, from the alcohol
consumption. So it's we're in a profession in law enforcement where we can't often point to saying, but for me or but for what we did, this individual wouldn't be alive today. I really believe that where we're directly involved in taking alcohol away from people, particularly the underage parties, that there are situations in which we can point to in which we say we actually did play a direct role in saving the life of that individual from whom we separated from alcohol. Now, I'm the speaker here today representing the Sheriff's Office, but the work that I'm talking about isn't my work. It actually was preceded by at least three sheriffs before me, but again, the Erie County Sheriff's Office has a very long history addressing this underage drinking problem. It actually began at least, if not before, with Sheriff Ken Braun, followed by Sheriff Higgins, and then by Sheriff Gallivan. But to review that history of that a little bit, in 1981, we had the creation of the Erie County Sheriff's Public Awareness is Prevention Program. Its initial focus was based on drug education. It involved canines drug education, assembly programs, drug displays, and programs for one-time offenders. Throughout the 1980s, we had heightened alcohol enforcement programs. We had the alcohol serving training program, which I think was among the first in the state, if not the first in the country, in which members of the Erie County Sheriff's Office did training programs for the bartenders on recognizing when individuals had had enough and how to deal with the person and the problems associated for not shutting someone off in the licensed establishments. Erie County Sheriff's Office had among the first grant-funded DWI patrols. One of those employees, Ellen Rosansky, is still with the Sheriff's Office, although his efforts now, I think, chief, are more on drug enforcement than the alcohol, I think, alcohol enforcement now. But Ellen Rosansky was among the first of the grant-funded Stop DWI patrols in New York State. Throughout the 80s and into the 90s, we had the development of community coalitions, which were very, very proud to be a part of, not that we were the organizer, but very proud that to have been a part of it. We've moved toward the science-based, school-based drug education programs with what was called Project Alert, which was a life skills training program actually founded by or invented by a man named Botvin. But in the 1990s, we actually came to the big turning point. This may have been a milestone, and it was with the help or with the direction of the suggestion of New York State, that we moved toward a state-directed focus on underage drinking in a recognition that it's not a minor problem campaign. It was at about that time that alcohol was branded as a drug. It was drugs and alcohol, and it began to recognize at least that alcohol, in fact, is a drug itself. It was not any different than other types of drug dependency. We continue to say drug and alcohol because of the stigma associated with them, but there's an ongoing change here. It was at about this same period of time that we began to use mass communications in an aim to change the norms about underage drinking. I want to talk specifically about the law enforcement role. We're a partner in this. We are not the driving force for years past, and we've had obviously some problems in the past. We thought, tell us this, your problem, and I guess it was like Sergeant Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am, only the facts. We didn't really want to hear how you felt about things, but recognizing that we're nothing more than a partner, but that we are a very significant and important partner in this, because we play a very unique role in that there are three different strategies that need to be applied here, and law enforcement is actually involved in all three of those different strategies. First, we have the regulations, the laws, and the policies. For some of the older members of the audience, and we'd have to talk maybe more toward many of your parents that you'd go back and ask this question, but it was in the 60s and the 70s, I think, Chief, you're not really old enough, the undersheriff would remember, that I think the original DWI laws had an effect of a 0.15. Does that sound correct? That initially, when we first talked about DWI enforcement, I think the law said that a person that had more than 0.15% of alcohol in their blood was considered to be intoxicated. Back when that law was first begun to enforce, there was absolutely no stigma attached at all. to having been stopped for DWI. It was very widely tolerated. Probably the mayor of a village or any other community leader could be recognized or seen in the bar as drinking and getting into his or her car and then driving home. And there was really no negative stigma associated with that at all. To one of the very earliest or first questions today that came from the audience, that's where we were. That's not where we are now. We still have a long ways to go, but law enforcement is one of the three partners in this, play a very important role in changing the way people feel, and it takes a very long time to change that, but in fact, change comes slowly, but it has been very effective because we're now down to where our DWI enforcements and our impairment is below 0.10. The availability is another area which law enforcement has been very directly involved, and that's the cutting off the different sources, all of the different sources of where underage people are able to get their alcohol. That's both from other minors purchasing alcohol, from adults purchasing alcohol, from the establishments that continue to profit by making alcohol available. They don't care who it is as long as we've got money coming in. We don't care who's buying it as long as we're getting money. And certainly then most difficult is the parents and discouraging the parents from cutting off these programs. And again, to number three, changing norms in the law enforcement role and helping with our other partners is to change the way society and different people in our communities feel about this. Certainly one of the most successful ways to have done this is through the mass communication, and certainly you'll hear more from the next speaker on the parent forum, something that has directly been taken on by schools and some communities to change how they feel. But the Erie County Sheriff's Office, with our other partners, has been involved in a multi-part public awareness campaign for the new millennium. In 2006, the Sheriff's Office transitioned from the school-based programs to the environmental professions prevention strategies that I've just talked about, where we talked or where we've attacked or addressed the sources, the public perception, and changing the norms. In collaboration with the Center for Health and Social Research at Buffalo State College, we have used a data-driven approach to target the highest risk areas within the Erie County Sheriff's Patrol districts. What we found from doing that, and again, it was toward the time, the research part of this, is looking at some of those things we saw before, the types of crimes that there's a close correlation between alcohol use and those types of crimes, and saw where those are happening most frequently within Erie County, and we did see that the southern part of Erie County, not completely different, but was actually across the southern border of Erie County, and seeing a close comparison on the northern border of our surrounding counties, that we did have a very specific problem, and deliberately and scientifically addressed and sent some of our resources to those areas and worked with three different communities in the southern tier in forming coalitions that have been, we think, quite successful. Our recruitment of coalition members continues. We continue to search for community partners. In these campaigns, we have used letter mailings, newspaper articles, local media ads. We use key informant interviews to identify the specific community problems and nuances. Again, back to those types of crimes, even teenage pregnancies, the dropout rates, the failure in school, late teens and early 20, alcoholism rates. Again, anything at all that points toward this problem that can help us to try to get these strategies and begin to work with our community groups sooner. Community buy-ins from schools, local businesses, parents, churches, and local government is truly the key to success, because where we don't have that, all of the law enforcement efforts, and again, historically, where law enforcement has tried to solve this problem by themselves, have not been successful. Where parents have tried to do this simply family to family, it's certainly not as successful where one school or one class would try to address this. But unless we're working at together, our efforts are certainly much more productive, much more successful when we are working this together. Over the last 3 years, the Sheriff's Office has fostered a relationship with three independent
geographic coalitions. I already made some reference to that. We do think that we're making a difference in those communities. We do recognize that we have a long ways to go. We're still changing the norms. Someone suggested even some problems with courts, that we need to get the courts to feel the same way that some of the parents and some of the law enforcement people feel and recognize this is a problem that can't be just addressed with a light slap on the wrist. We need something more severe or more significant in the form of penalties. We've established working relationships with area schools and businesses. Obviously, the businesses are important because it's the funding, a source of funding, but the schools are important because that's one of the best places to be addressing this, that if we're not doing it in cooperation with the schools, we can say it with the parents and the family, we can say it with the law enforcement encounters on the street, but if we're not hearing it or reinforcing it in the schools, our chances of being successful are diminished. We have done, I think, six mass media campaigns that we think that they've been effective. I want to share that with individuals so that they know about them. Some of them may be resurrected. Some of them could be replicated in other areas where they haven't been done before. I will tell you that they've all been a lot of fun to do. Law enforcement has a very special relationship with the media. It's built over the years because of cooperative efforts, because of open exchange of information. So we should capitalize on our relationships with the media to get some information out that actually helps us to accomplish one of our missions. Our Erie County Sheriff's Underage Drinking Media Campaign has made, obviously, use of the mass media to change the community norms. We could not do this. I have to say it again. We could not do this without the help of the mass media. Using the mass media is an effective use of funds to reach, we've found this out, to reach the maximum target audience. In other words, to get the biggest bang for our buck. Some of the communications we have used, posters and placards. We have a lot of this. A lot of these are here up today to be examined. We have certainly copies if anybody wants to take home, but we have used both posters that we have done, posters that have been done in schools, posters that have been done in contests. We've done postcards. One of the postcards that we did was Serve Minors, Serve Time. We're actually distributed to every middle and high school in Erie County. You have examples of these in your folder along with the table tents, the underage drinking message that was distributed to every licensed liquor establishment within Erie County. We had the billboards. We loved seeing the billboards. They targeted very specific audiences. They were some of them done on trailers that could be moved. We used them for different periods of time when we knew we had, for instance, at the Christmas gatherings when we knew people were driving, drinking and driving to, again, remind people what how easy it would be to ruin a holiday because you're out drinking at Christmas time. And then, as the poster suggests, don't run over Santa Claus. We've collaborated in doing this with other prevention agencies. One of the things that we have done that we have found to be kind of an untested ground, very new ground, was to go to the movie theaters. We have had a did with National Cinema in partnership again with the business that we got them to agree that if we presented an appropriate message that they would broadcast or show that message at their different movie theaters. We have a very large and diverse audience that attends the theaters. It was an opportunity. We're not with family, either if it's young children or sometimes parents with the teenagers, not maybe so often, that attended movies together. But at any time that we got that message out, even if they went to the theater and went to two different movies, they both saw the same message, that it was a prompt to have a discussion with their teenagers or their younger children after that. But it was a very wide geographic reach. We found it to be very cost effective for a very small cost of producing the video. We are still having as many as few as 100,000 people every month that is seeing this message. And again, depending on seasons and holidays, the attendance at the theaters is very easily gauged. That we have in some months as many as 300,000 people seeing it. Is it time to key up the, just to show you what the message was?
Hey, Erie County Sheriff Tim Howard, reminding you about, if you buy alcohol for minors, you're gambling with their lives as well as your own. That's together to keep alcohol out of the hands of underage drinkers?
Yeah, well, this is the second one we did, right? This is the third? Yep. We had another one about just reminding parents what the source of the alcohol was, to go home and look in their own medicine cabinets to kind of keep an inventory of their own. But again, it was fairly inexpensive to produce, and again, with the cooperation of the movie theaters, we were very grateful that they put it out. One of the things that we talked about very early today, actually when the commissioner was here, was this tip line program. We wish that we claimed that the tip line was created in New York County, but it doesn't matter where it was created. I think it actually came from Genesee County, that was a volunteer group. But at any rate, at the time that Erie County became aware of that, and all of the Erie County police agencies and signed on to push this idea and to promise to respond to these calls, we were the fifth law enforcement agency or the fifth county to sign on to it. And since that time, 15 additional. Just within Erie County, we're getting 8 to 20 calls every month. Again, it's somewhat seasonal. As a result of that tip line, we had a very large underage party in Grand Island that was discovered and police responded to. Another large party in Clarence that was a very large party. If you saw about it in the news in East Aurora, in which the students were actually going from the party directly to the school. We have had multiple tips from that tip line involving bars and stores that continue to serve alcohol to underage drinkers to make it available. Among our other programs, we did, the Serve Kids, Serve Time program, a poster. Actually, I think that was one of the most moving things we did, a full-color poster here that was Choose Your Ride. There were three good choices and one obviously bad choice, that if you failed to make the right choice, the ride you chose was likely to be in a hearse. In our program, underage drinking could cost you. We know that the different periods of different seasons, different times of the year, we have different focuses. Obviously, the prom and graduations that are coming upon us, the Red Ribbon Week. It's done with the cooperation with DEA in memory of a DEA agent that sacrificed his life in Mexico. The Red Ribbon Baseball Game, just the first night drug-free tree. And in our history of continuing to work with any of the treatment facilities, the kids escaping drugs and mental health. Kind of in review, the role of law enforcement in changing the norms and policies, the access for the illegal underaged sales is a place that we need to continue to keep our efforts and our focus on to try to cut it off at the source, the hosting issues, and again, to target norms supporting the providing of alcohol to youth, particularly at the prom parties and the graduation parties, to continue to collaborate with the parents, the schools, and the prevention agencies. And again, our gathering here today is actually a demonstration of that. PX 2010 or PX 20, meaning the 21st century, and 2010 obviously is the reference to this year. Next year's program will be 2011. It is the collaborative effort in Erie County. We want to continue to encourage the parent forums. I don't know that there's anything that's more successful and more exciting that I've seen for a recent development than the parent forums. We've kind of kept you a little anticipation of that, but again, that's going to be the next speaker. Strong support for any parent drug awareness programs. We'd like to see these adopted across the county in all of the different schools. We think it's a very effective tool for law enforcement to partner with the schools and the prevention agencies. The Erie County Sheriff's Office has funded literature for these parent forums. We have a reduction in state funding. While we have a reduction in state funding for school resource officers, we no doubt that the law enforcement agencies, regardless of who's funding them, the state, the county, or the local agencies, will continue to support this type of effort in our schools. If I just play first my own message that we did in support of the parent forum, and I'll call the next speaker if you want to get ready, Superintendent. I don't think that there's a law enforcement officer or law enforcement executive, mayor, that doesn't share that thought. But back to the collaborative effort here. We could produce 100 things like that very inexpensively. But who's going to listen to it? When are we going to get the people together to hear it? But for these joint efforts, our collaborative efforts, which we are extremely proud. And again, not any credit to me, credit to the people that are in this room, credit to the sheriffs that have preceded me, credit to the law enforcement officers that are here to continue to work with their communities and make them aware of the fact that we want to work with our communities to make them a safer place. I have to tell you, I felt great in making that video and spent a lot of time working on the script with the help of some other people to what message that we want to get out, but nothing that was said in that, there's not a greater tragedy that law enforcement faces than or more difficult task than going back to a family and telling them that a member of their family won't be coming home again. And we know in our hearts, and we know from what we've seen, that alcohol played a part in that, and we could have done something about it. And too often, after the tragedy, we step up with the community and do. The communities we see represented here are ahead of the curve, and I want to congratulate all of you for that. And again, tell you that I haven't seen a program that I was more excited about than the one that's going on in Lakeshore. And at this time, I'm very pleased to introduce Superintendent Jeff Raby, who's the superintendent of the Lakeshore Schools. I'm working with the Family Community Coalition, with the Community Coalition, Western New York United, and the ECC PASA. Superintendent has successfully introduced the first local parent drug awareness forums in his schools as a prerequisite to the student participation in any extracurricular activity. Superintendent, are most welcome.
Thank you, Sheriff. Good morning, everyone. Very happy to be here today. I'm just so thrilled. I'm doing a presentation this morning, and it's not about my budget. I'm out doing about 20 presentations right now, so this is very nice. This is a tremendous opportunity for one school community to share a problem and a solution with the other communities in Western New York. It took us a while to understand and appreciate it, but underage drinking is everybody's problem. There were several incidents that took place within the Lakeshore School community in a very narrow period of time in 2005. These incidents brought significant concern and awareness to a growing problem of students participating in risky behaviors. There were students caught in possession of great amounts of alcohol. There were large underage parties with alcohol and drugs, which resulted in the involvement of law enforcement and students losing privileges at school. And there were several episodes of risky behavior that resulted in personal injuries, the unintentional injuries, including a fatality. I think it is important to bring awareness to the fact that the school is viewed as the binding agent and the authority to take action within a community. Therefore, when the community begins to reach out for help, they turn to the school first. In the summer of 2005, that is exactly what happened. The Board of Education was approached by a mother of a student who fell off a balcony at an underage drinking party. As a result of the fall, her son died. Mrs. Janice Drubel, personal hero of mine, who is here today, wanted the school district to get involved on behalf of her son, Matthew, and to ensure that this tragic accident did not happen to another child in our school community. Mrs. Drubel was a mother on a mission. It was clearly communicated that the school community had enough. We knew that we needed to move from a mode of reaction to true prevention and connect with our parents. A grassroots group began to meet. It was made up of parents, law enforcement, including our DARE officer, school board members, administrators, and other community members. After a few meetings, the mission was identified, and the Citizens for Responsible Choices, or CRC, was officially formed. Throughout this time, we had many focused conversations, and we began to recognize the considerable disconnect between the prevention message that the school district was trying to send and our parents. This was the point where the Citizens for Responsible Choices proposed an innovative idea to the school district. I will always remember the day that I received that phone call. It started, "Mr. Raby, how much of a risk taker are you?" And Mr. Matt Smith sitting up here is the one who made that call. Do you remember that, Matt? The idea was indeed risky but courageous. The only other school in the country to attempt what the CRC was proposing was a private Catholic school in Tucson, Arizona. And it's important to note that private Catholic schools can impose many more regulations and restrictions than a public school, as they are a school of choice. You can choose to follow the rules or simply go somewhere else. Public schools don't quite have that flexibility. When reviewing the initiative that the CRC was proposing, it was clear that in order for the proposal to be successful, it would need a significant amount of support from the high school administration, the district office, and most importantly, the Board of Education. This level of support was critical in validating the importance of the commitment on behalf of the school district to connect with parents in delivering the prevention message. The partnerships involved in delivering the prevention message were the Lakeshore Central School District, Western New York United Against Drugs and Alcohol Abuse, Erie County Council for the Prevention of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, and the Town of Evans Police Department, and the Citizens for Responsible Choices. This partnership was the critical foundation for the prevention message to be delivered effectively to our parents. With the support from all levels of the school district and an established partnership for prevention, the parent drug and alcohol awareness seminars were formed. The 90-minute sessions required parent attendance in order for their son or daughter to attend school dances. The parents only had to attend once in a 4-year period of time, and they only had to attend one seminar for multiple children. Yes, we were using the school dances as our hook to get the parents to listen to our message. Risky, but courageous. The purpose of the 90-minute prevention seminar is to increase the parents' knowledge of legal implications of underage drinking and drug use, including the consequences for hosting parties. It reveals for parents the signs and symptoms of abuse. The parents are able to recognize the various drugs, their street names, and drug paraphernalia. They become familiar with potential health risks associated with short and long-term abuse. And most importantly, they understand how to truly partner with the school in order to keep our youth of our community safe. It was important from the onset that the format of each 90-minute seminar be consistent in its delivery. The program begins with a welcome and an introduction from the high school administrator to basically explain the importance of the seminar and lay out the design for the rest of the session. Then a representative from Western New York United Against Drugs and Alcohol Abuse introduces a video on the risks and influences of drugs and alcohol. The next phase of the program is a presentation on the drugs and drug paraphernalia by the Erie County Council for the Prevention of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse. Then the parents receive a legal overview from a representative from the Town of Evans Police Department. Typically, this representative is our former DARE officer who delivers this message and with whom the parents are very comfortable. The 90-minute session concludes with a question and answer period and the ever-important evaluation. One of the most talked about positive responses that we receive around the presentation is from Sally Yagarek from the Erie County Council for Prevention and Alcoholism and Substance Abuse. Sally delivers a paraphernalia show and tell, and she does have it with us here today, or part of it. I don't think the whole thing is here. Includes items such as demonstrating how lipsticks, highlighters, and tinfoil are used as pipes, how young adults use toilet paper rolls stuffed with dryer sheets to mask the smell of marijuana, how flasks are disguised as flip-flops and cell phones, how water bottles are altered to be used as a stash container, and the availability and health risks of energy drinks and caffeine shots. This part of the presentation really shakes parents up and raises their level of awareness to a whole other level. So 4 years later, where are we? In the fall of 2006, we started with the introduction of 6 presentations for the attendance of 2 dances, the winter ball and the prom. We continued with the 2007-2008 school year with 5 presentations at the high school for attendance at all 5 dances and added an annual spring middle school program for 8th grade parents. Currently, 90% of all of our parents have attended at least one of the seminars. Believe it or not, some parents have actually come back for a second experience. We are very proud of that. Sally Yagarek made a profound statement about the exposure of the parents to the prevention message. In all my years of presenting this important information, I was never able to reach the amount of parents that I have been able to reach through these seminars. If you think about it, when a school district offers a presentation for parents to come on a volunteer basis, we only get the parents that really don't need the message. They are already doing what they need to do as a parent. That is why they would attend an open session on a volunteer basis. We need to mandate the presentation in order to get the audience, But once we had them, we had them. As we were able to deliver the prevention message that we needed to deliver and connect with our parents, we needed to share the important information with them so that we could partner with our parents in this prevention fight. The feedback that we received from parents before they experienced the seminar was, why do we have to do this? And you are holding our kids hostage. And my favorite, this is the dumbest decision you have ever made. And obviously they didn't know all the other dumb decisions we've made for that. We were able to move quickly from negative comments prior to the seminar to the responses that we heard while the parents were experiencing the seminar. Like, wow, why are companies allowed to sell this stuff? We never knew. This is so scary, and the teachers need to hear this stuff. And actually, that was a great piece of feedback that we immediately acted on, and we held a seminar for all of the teaching staff and faculty beginning in 2007-08 school year with positive results from the teachers. At the conclusion of the seminar, we were able to validate our initiative. At the end of each session, the parents completed an evaluation of the program. We asked if they believed that the topics covered were relevant and helpful. 98.7% of the parents responded yes. We also asked if there were other things that they would like to see included in the seminars. 87% said yes and offered where parents can get help, the behavior traits to look for in kids and sex, and over-the-counter drugs. We have made adjustments to the seminars along the way as information has changed and when parents' needs have changed. We continued by asking if the information given by the presenters was interesting and well-prepared. 99% affirmed that it was. We asked if questions and concerns were answered to their satisfaction, and 99% confirmed that they were. We asked if they would recommend the form to other parents, and 97% said yes, they would. As always, quantitative data is great, but the most meaningful feedback comes from the direct comments, such as, I am very happy because it gave me a wake-up, helped me understand what is going on. I was surprised by what was said. I learned new things to watch out for. Now I know what to look for in my home. We need to know these things as parents. Parenting is a lifelong commitment. And this topic relies on parenting at home and developing responsible individuals. So as we reviewed the evaluations, reflected on the comments, and had conversations with our parents after the sessions, it became clear to us that we did the right thing, all from a mother's mission. There is widespread consensus proven in research that family engagement is a critical ingredient for a child's school success, from cradle to career. More importantly, establishing relationships is a critical ingredient for a child's life success. Those relationships or partnerships range from parent to teacher, from parent to counselor, from a grassroots community group made up of parents to an entire school district. We feel as if we move from calling them partnerships to calling them parentships. The Lakeshore School community has taken this notion to a different level and has been connecting with students and their families in ways that we never connected with them before. We have revamped our comprehensive school counseling program and family support center. We have developed a freshman academy to build and enhance our relationships with our students and their families at one of their most vulnerable times in their lives, transitioning to high school. And in the fall, we're going to be partnering with Prevention Focus to implement some more prevention programs for that particular academy, and including gambling, which was mentioned earlier on. We are working hard toward establishing a new Boys and Girls Club in Lakeshore, which is scheduled to open its doors in the fall of 2010. We are enhancing our prevention programs within our school day with our partners in prevention, Western New York United Against Drugs and Alcohol Abuse, and Prevention Focus. If there is one important thing that we have learned through this learning experience, it is when there is a community problem identified, the solution can also be found within the community, as relationships, parentships, and collaborations can be fostered to achieve success for our children in solving the problems that confront them on a daily basis. It has been my honor to share our story with you today. Thank you for your time, and I wish you well in your prevention efforts.
Thank you, Superintendent. We have to ask if any school or a long time ago had a drug education programs and they'd offered them for the parents to come in, how many parents do you think would have ever come? So I really think the answer is this is a case where all of us want to do the right thing, but without the push that came from that, without that daring move that you made in which you made it mandatory, without obviously the community support that you worked hard to get, but a 98.6 rate is unbelievable. And you know why I said I don't think there's a more exciting program out there that can make a difference, a prevention program than this one. So I really, now you know why I said I would love to see this replicated. Have other schools picked up on it since?
Yes, different versions, but I think between 10 and 15. Is that about right, 10 or 15? 10 or 15 schools.
Yep. If your community won't support it, you have to ask why. I mean, what's wrong in your community that they won't support a program like this? Do we want to say that the parents don't have anything to do? I mean, I've got a couple of daughters involved in education. They say the problem is they don't have any cooperative efforts, any group efforts with parents where they have problem students, but this is certainly the seed for that. So, again, it was made to address one problem, but I really see where this goes on to address education problems and other cooperative efforts as well. So congratulations for that program. Now, my pleasure to introduce our final speaker, Matt Smith. I knew Matt when he was with Western New York United, but he's moved on now as the Executive Director of Prevention Focus Incorporated. So, Matt, take us home. And I guess this is my last chance at the podium. I want to thank you all once again for coming into this. And good luck, and we're there to help you if we can.
Please give Sheriff Howard a round of applause. Thank you, Sheriff. You know, I was looking at the agenda, and I saw that I happened to be the ninth item on the agenda. And as a sports-minded person, I immediately slipped to a baseball analogy where I realized I'm batting last. Now, not only did that give me somewhat of a blow to my self-esteem, batting last in the order, I also realized I am the only thing standing between you and the rest of your busy day. Not a great place to be in. I've been in this roster spot before. But rather than getting hung up on that, I realized I need to be very, very grateful because I've been given a tremendous gift. I have been given the last word. And I don't get that in my home very often. I don't always get it in my normal work life. However, my friends in the prevention field that all participate in PX20 allowed me to speak on behalf of the group and get that last word in on behalf of them. And I assure you, friends at PX20, I will not abuse the privilege. It'll be a quick final word, and hopefully one that does the trick. I have a couple things to accomplish with my time here at the podium. One, I do need to say thank you and recognize a couple of people, not the least of which is Don Boswell and our friends at WNED-TV for allowing us to have this event here today. I'd also like to recognize Denise Fulkerson and Jerry Puma from AWASAS, because without AWASAS, none of these organizations, none of these things are happening. So thank you very much for your continued support. I would like to also recognize Mr. Bill Fremgen. Bill, would you give a wave to everybody, please? One thing that didn't get said yet, which I need to make sure I say, is that Bill is the convener of PX20. He is the facilitator. He sits at the head of the table. And all these efforts that have begun and all these efforts that will go on from here come as a result of his quiet but determined leadership, and I thank you, Bill, for all you've done for that group. And one other person I'd like to recognize, it was referenced in the last presentation, and she's going to hate me for this, but Janice Struble is the lady who lost her son and was the spark for the whole initiative that happened out at Lakeshore. And Janice, you don't get this a lot, and this is selfish of me because I want to keep you going. Would you please stand up, Janice? Just for a second, and please applaud Janice Struble for her efforts and her energy. Thank you. And it's not in her nature, so please forgive me, Janice, for that. A couple other housekeeping kind of things. If you are needing CPP credit, please make sure you sign in. We'd hate to see you not get those important hours towards your credential. I also need to really ask for the two pieces of paper that were on your tables when you came in. Again, these documents will help us to shape future events as well as what we focus on as we move forward taking on this complex issue. My last role with this time was to hopefully do a little bit of a recap quickly and also to inspire. I guess one message I want to make sure everybody gets is that prevention can work and does work every single day. Now, it's a field where successes are measured over years and over decades, not in moments. And in a culture of microwave ovens and sound bites and drive-through windows, that runs counter to the culture that we all live in. But we ask you to keep doing the good work, to please be patient, because this stuff does work. We know it does. We have the science to prove it. It just takes a while to get there. My heart goes out to the lady that spoke earlier about the problems that she was encountering when she was working through the system to try to make some changes. And I guess all I can say to people who have encountered those issues is this is about attitude and behavior change, things that do not happen with humans very, very easily. And every subset of the population is impacted by our cause. And that includes judges, that includes law enforcement officers and police chiefs. It includes superintendents and teachers and principals, in addition to parents and everybody else. It is everybody's problem, and those changes in attitude eventually lead to where we want to go. So this work causes us to change our beliefs about underage drinking, and just think for a minute about where we were 20 years ago, when there was underage drinking going on with 16-year-olds, it was not really even considered to be that big of a deal. Now parties happen, and it's headlines and heard about on the radio, and players unfortunately get kicked off sports teams. But we have raised the awareness, we have raised the importance of the issue, and over time, it is beginning to show some results, and we need to keep working at that. One thing that Karen Carpenter Palumbo said that struck me was that we are only serving 15% of the need in New York State. And in this time of shrinking resources, how can we increase that number to meet the needs that are so obviously there? And the answer is you. It is indeed everybody's problem. But I'd also like to look at each individual room in the room here in the eye and tell you it's your problem. And those that do this work every day, I'd like to believe in my heart, know that, but we always need reminding. And those of you that are not directly working in this field, I'd like you to think about that for a second. Underage drinking is incredibly costly. And I'd like you to think in your mind about the people that it impacts. Think about the lives that are interrupted in addition to those that are actually lost. Think about the poor grades that may result in the not getting into the college of a person who could have achieved great things. Think about the relationships that erode and fall apart as a result of alcohol abuse when a person loses the love of their life because of this disease. It all started because of underage drinking. Think about the jobs lost, the lack of productivity, the potential that doesn't occur as a result of that. And then think to yourself, what can I do about it? Now, I think we've laid some things out today. We've got some things in your packet that you can take with you. We've got materials like crazy over here on the tables, which unfortunately still have way too many things on them. So please participate in that and do take those along. But the field of prevention stands at the ready to help you. And I'm going to ask right now, and again, I hope my compatriots in the field don't get too mad at me for this, but those of you that are in the room, that have been participating in PX20, I'd like you to all please just for a moment stand up. You have a lot of friends who are here waiting to support you, okay? There's Tara Koroleski from the Erie County Department of Mental Health, along with Bill Fremkin. There's Bill Wysorek, you heard from earlier. There's Mike Licata of the Sheriff's Department. Al Delmerico from the Center for Health and Social Research. Tom McNulty from the Mental Health Association. Lucy Candelaria, Westside Community Services. Bart Bloom, Action for Mental Health. Andrea Wannett, ECPASA. Giselle Jackman from my organization, Prevention Focus. Danette Turner from EPIC. Pete Hill from Native American Services. Kate Chidoba, Tim Smykowski, Linda Flowers, all from Western New York United Against Drug and Alcohol Abuse. And if I've left anybody out because my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, who have I left? Oh, absolutely. Karen Smith from Western New York United, Sally Yagarek from ECPASA. All of these people would be delighted to get a phone call or an email from any one of you to put this stuff to work. You can give them a round of applause because they stood this long. And now they can sit. But I leave you with just this one thought. Everybody's problem, yes. Your problem, absolutely. But we're here to help you. And we work for cheap or we work for free as far as you're concerned. Please give us a call. Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day. We hope to get a phone call from many of you very soon.